His frown deepened. Each column was almost 3 miles long, and Stainair's 15 ships were about 6 miles to leeward of his own as they angled out towards the enemy. Dreadnought was creeping just a bit to the north of the point Caleb had originally selected, but that didn't bother him. Captain Manthir had spotted the enormous galley flying the command streamer of a Dolaran admiral and adjusted his course to pass astern of it accordingly. Spurts of dirty gray-white smoke began to erupt from some of the nearer galleys. The probability of anyone hitting anything from that range, especially with pre-Merlin artillery, was as close to non-existent as anything Caleb could think of. He couldn't even see the splashes where most of the round shot, which had to be aimed at Dreadnought, hit the water. He pondered the situation for a moment longer, then shrugged. The plan he and Stainair and Merlin had put together was the best they'd been able to come up with between them. He wasn't going to start mucking about with it simply because he had a bad case of first battle nerves. He snorted quietly, amused by his own thoughts, and didn't even notice how his sudden smile relaxed the shoulders of the officers standing about him on the flagship's quarterdeck. "About 15 minutes I make it, Captain Manthir," he said conversationally.
"About that, Your Highness,"
Manthir agreed.
"Very well, then, Captain," Caleb said more formally. "Engage the enemy."
"Aye, aye, Your Highness."
Fadel Alvarez, Duke of Malachi, stood on King Ronald's aftercastle and watched the column of galleons headed towards his flagship. The lead ship in the enemy line was one of the largest in the Carizian formation, and Malachi's jaws clenched as it drew close enough for him to see the coronet above the Golden Kraken flying from its mizzen peak. Only one person in all of Caris was entitled to fly that flag, the heir to the throne. Caleb, he thought. Crown Prince Caleb Armok himself, bearing down upon him like the get of some demon. Malachi hadn't placed much faith in the Church's obvious suspicions about Caris's orthodoxy, but how else to explain those galleons' presence better than 7,000 miles sail from Rockshoal Bay? How else to explain how they could even have found his fleet, much less appeared to be in exactly the right position to press home their attack? Cold, dull terror burned deep inside him, made still worse by the proximity of Armageddon Reef. He should never have allowed Thirsk and Whiteford to talk him into staying so close to this accursed land. He should have sailed as he always intended to, as he'd been ordered to. Far better to have risked losing his entire fleet to wind and storm than to have it destroyed by the legions of hell. Captain Eckard stood by the port bulwark, watching the oncoming enemy intently, and Malachi glared at his flag captain's back. Eckard had recommended ordering the fleet to put about, even if it had to do so under oars, after the first unknown sail had been sighted. Malachi had brushed the suggestion aside, of course. The sighting report had probably been in error, and even if it hadn't, there couldn't possibly have been anything else behind that lone sail, certainly not anything capable of threatening a fleet the size of his. Now his own flag captain was ignoring him. Malachi glared at Eckard's straight spine, then touched the hilt of his sword. He eased it in its sheath, making certain it moved freely, and then looked at the gunners crouching above the breeches of their cannon. Eckard had argued against Malachi's orders this morning as well. He'd wanted to try to stay away from the Carizians, far enough that the guns of his lofty ship could at least hope to hit them, rather than close straight into their own guns, but Malachi had overruled him harshly. Those galleons might have more artillery than any of his ships did, but his galleys each carried enormous crews, buttressed by heavy drafts on the finest regiments of the Royal Army. If they could ever lay one of those galleons alongside, sweep over its decks with their boarding pikes, swords, and axes, it wouldn't matter how many guns the accursed thing had. And whatever Eckard might think,
Malachi had 5 times as many galleys as they had galleons. He bared his teeth, matching anger at his flag captain's cowardice against the cold poison of his own fear, as more guns began to fire aboard other galleys, and the Carizzians drew implacably closer and closer. The first few round shot whimpered through the air above Dreadnought like lost, damned souls. One of them hit the main topsail and punched through the wet canvas with the slap of a giant's fist. Another skipped across the ship's bows barely 5 feet in front of her, and then she took her first true hit. A round shot, probably an 8-pounder from a long falcon, slammed into her below the spar deck hammock nettings and just forward of the mainmast. It erupted through the starboard bulwark in a burst of jagged splinters and cut a standing marine in half in an explosion of blood. Yells and a few screams announced that the splinters had inflicted wounds of their own, and more than one member of Dreadnought's crew flinched. But she continued to forge steadily ahead, and the massive bulk of King Ronald was less than 70 yards away.
"Stand ready to port your helm," Captain Eckard said to his first lieutenant. "Our best chance is going to come after they pass astern of us."
"Yes, sir."
Malachi's lips twisted with contempt as he heard the faint quaver in the lieutenant's voice. The other man's obvious fear was a welcome distraction from his own, and he drew his sword as the end of Dreadnought's long bowsprit began to pass across King Ronald's wake barely 50 yards behind the flagship.
"Fire as you bear!"
Captain Manthir bellowed as Dreadnought presented the muzzles of her forward guns to her target. King Ronald's high, massive stern towered above the low-slung galleon. Despite the wear and tear the galley had suffered over the thousands of miles she had voyaged to reach this point, despite the sea slime and tendrils of weed along her waterline, traces of gilding still clung to the magnificent carving, gleaming against the vibrant color of broken gray cloud and bright blue sky in the morning light. Green water and white spray curled back from her hull as the seas washed higher than her lower bank of oar ports, and the rows of her vast stern windows flashed back the sun, despite the rime of salt which encrusted them. Helmets could be seen above the aftercastle's bulwark, glinting dully with the sheen of steel, and more sunlight glittered from the points of boarding pikes and the blades of axes and halberds, the barrels of matchlock muskets. The galley's reefed replacement sail, patched and worn, bellied out like a shield, and shouts of defiance rang out. But those shouts sounded half-hearted, and they were met only by silence from Dreadnought's disciplined crew. Fire flashed in King Ronald's stern gun ports, but the ports were too high. The gunners had mistimed the ship's motion, and Dreadnought was too close to her. Her guns, unlike Carizzian artillery, couldn't be depressed, and the balls screamed across Dreadnought without hitting a thing and plunged uselessly into the water far beyond her. And then the galleon's forward guns came to bear. Gun by gun, the muzzles belched flame and choking smoke as the captains jerked their firing lanyards. The range was less than 60 yards, and unlike King Ronald's gunners, the gun crews had timed their own ship's motion almost perfectly. Gunport by gunport, down the full length of the galleon's side, guns lurched back, recoiling in a mad chorus of squealing gun trucks as their round shot, each shot with a charge of grapeshot for good measure, smashed into King Ronald like an iron avalanche. The galley's stern windows disappeared, blotted away as Dreadnought's raking fire turned that magnificent sternwork into the mouth of a gaping cave of horror. Round shot and grapeshot ripped down the full length of the ship. Splinters flew. Men screamed, and the billowing smoke of the broadside hid the carnage of its impact. There was time for only one shot from each gun as the galleon crossed King Ronald's stern, but Captain Manthir's voice rang out.
"Off sheets and braces! Starboard your helm!" he shouted.
Duke Malachi's world disintegrated in a stunning eruption of devastation. He'd never imagined, never dreamed of, anything like the long, unending bellow of Dreadnought's broadside. 27 guns hurled round shot, 6.5 inches in diameter, each weighing over 38 pounds and accompanied by 27-inch-and-a-half grape shot into his ship. They came crashing in through the galley's stern, totally undeterred by the flimsy glass and carved planking, and smashed clear to the bow, killing and maiming anyone in their path. That carefully aimed and timed broadside killed or wounded over 130 of King Ronald's crew. Men shrieked as round shot, grape shot, and splinters of their own ship ripped into them. Blood sprayed across deck planks in great grotesque patterns, and men who'd never imagined such a hurricane of fire, men already demoralized and frightened by the inexplicable appearance of their enemies so many thousands of miles from Karis, stared in horror at their mangled crewmates. Most of Dreadnought's fire went in below the level of King Ronald's aftercastle. Half a dozen round shot crashed directly through the galley's great cabin, exploding out from under the break of the aftercastle and cutting great blood-splashed furrows through the men packing her deck. But at least 2 shots ripped upward, directly through the aftercastle, and Malachi staggered as a blizzard of splinters howled through the officers gathered there. Something big, heavy and fast-moving slammed into his own breastplate, nearly knocking him from his feet. But the armor held. The impact spun him around, just in time to see Captain Eckard stumble backward, clutching at the thick splinter which had driven into the side of his neck like a jagged-edged harpoon. Blood sprayed around the splinter like water from the nozzle of a pump, and the captain thudded to the deck. Malachi fought for balance as the final shots of Dreadnought's thundering broadside hammered into his flagship. His mind seemed stunned, as if it were caught in some thick, dragging quicksand. He stared about wildly and saw Dreadnought passing clear of his ship to starboard. The galleon put her helm over, turning steadily to port, taking the wind broad on her beam rather than directly astern. Her yards moved smoothly, with machine-like precision, as she settled on the port tack, 100 yards to leeward, between King Ronald and Armageddon Reef, like a kraken between a new-hatched sea wyvern and the land. The confusion and carnage her fire had wreaked paralyzed King Ronald. The galley's captain was dead. Her first lieutenant was mortally wounded. Her helmsmen lay bleeding their lives out on the deck. By the time her second lieutenant could begin reasserting control, Dreadnought had settled on her new heading, and her broadside thundered again. Fresh round shot battered into the galley's towering starboard side, not her flimsier stern. The thicker planking offered little more resistance to the galleon's heavy shot, but it provided more and bigger splinters to slice lethally into her crew. And as Dreadnought fired into her yet again, HMS Destroyer, Dreadnought's next astern, crossed King Ronald's wake and raked her all over again. Malachi turned back from Dreadnought as Destroyer opened fire, and in the second galleon's thundering guns he saw the destruction of his fleet. None of his galleys could begin to match the concentrated power of Caleb's galleons. They were hopelessly spread out and disordered, while the Carisian ships were in a compact, well-controlled formation, firing their guns with impossible rapidity, and galleys were at a hopeless maneuver disadvantage in the existing sea conditions. Numbers meant nothing unless they could be brought to bear, and his couldn't be. He heard the flagship's second lieutenant shouting orders to the replacement helmsman, fighting desperately to at least turn King Ronald's stern away from that terrible raking fire. But even as the lumbering galley began finally, reluctantly, to answer to her helm, a round shot cut away her mainmast below deck level. It smashed across the deck and into the water, and the galley lurched wildly, indescribably, as she found herself suddenly helpless. The wreckage alongside acted like a huge sea anchor, dragging her around, and still that merciless fire smashed into her again and again and again. Malachi stared aft, his stunned brain reeling, as the third ship in Caleb's line came crashing in. King Ronald had turned enough for HMS Daring's fire to hammer into her quarter instead of directly into her stern, but the flagship wasn't really her primary target. Duke of Fern, the next galley astern of King Ronald, had shaken out one of her reefs as she fought to come to the fleet commander's assistance. She heeled dangerously under the greater sail area, but she also drove through the water faster, only to find herself driving straight into the fire of Daring's starboard broadside as well. Malachi cringed as the volcanic fury of the galleon's fire erupted. He could hardly see through the choking pall of gunsmoke, but the wall of smoke lifted on the fiery breath of yet another galleon's broadsides as HMS Defense came into action as well. She blasted her fury into his ship and into Duke of Fern, and behind her came HMS Devastation. All he could hear was the thunder of Carisian artillery. It seemed to come from every direction, from all directions, as Dreadnought's consorts followed her around, pushing steadily southwest. They were faster, much faster, under sail than any of his galleys, and their guns fired steadily, mercilessly, with that same impossible rapidity as they overtook ship after ship. King Ronild's motion was growing heavier and heavier. Her hull must be filling with water, Malachi thought vaguely as he staggered to the side. He leaned on a shattered bulwark, aware of the heaps of bodies and parts of bodies littering the aftercastle. The main deck was a chaos of corpses where the men Captain Eckard had assembled for the boarding attempt which had never happened lay piled in mangled drifts, and he looked over the side at the thick tendrils of blood oozing from the galley's scuppers. It was as if the ship herself were bleeding, a corner of his brain thought. And then something made him look up, as Devastation swung around the shattered, slowly foundering hulk which had once been the pride of the Dolaran Navy. He raised his head just in time to see the thunderous flash of the galleon's guns. It was the last sight he ever saw. Dreadnought forged steadily south, leaning to the press of the northeasterly wind. The thunderous cannonade astern of her continued unabated as the other ships of her column crossed the Southern Force's line of advance, then turned to follow in her wake. The strong breeze rolled a billowing fog bank of gunsmoke towards the barely visible smudge of Rock Point, and the ferocity of the fire still roaring behind her indicated that at least some of the galleys north of Malachi's sinking flagship continued trying to fight their way through to the Duke's side with futile gallantry. Neither Caleb nor Merlin was much concerned by that possibility. The entire enemy fleet was too spread out and straggling to concentrate enough ships for the sort of hammer blow it would take to break past the galleon's broadsides. If they wanted to come in ones and twos, Caleb was content to leave the problem of their destruction to his captain's discretion while he concentrated on the rest of the Southern force.
"I think we need a little more speed, Gwillem," he said, glancing up from the billow of smoke still 2 miles ahead, where Admiral Stainair's column had also broken across the enemy's course, to check the sun's height. Captain Manthir glanced upward at the topsails and masthead pendant, gauging the strength of the wind, then waited while a fresh broadside thundered. The galley which had tried to break west, away from Dreadnought, staggered as the galleon's starboard guns hammered her from astern. Rigging parted, her single mast crashed over the side, and she rounded to as the wreckage dragged at her.
"Set the topgallants," the captain suggested.
"For now," Caleb agreed.
"Aye, aye, your highness."
Manthir lifted his leather speaking trumpet.
"Master Gerard,
"Hands to make sail, if you please. Let's get the topgallants on her." "Aye, aye, sir."
The first lieutenant acknowledged the order and started giving orders of his own, and seamen from the port gun crews went scampering up the ratlines to lay out along the topgallant yards, while others raced to the forecastle and after deck and along the spar decks above the guns to the pin rails to cast off sheets, bunt lines, and clue lines.
"Loose topgallants!"
Manthir bellowed through his speaking trumpet, and the hands aloft ungasketed the sails, untying the gaskets which fastened the canvas to the yards. The captain watched them critically, fingers of his left hand drumming slowly against his thigh, while his ship's guns put another bellowing broadside into the galley to starboard.
"Let fall the topgallants!"
the captain shouted, and the hands aloft pushed the canvas off the yard into its gear.
"Sheet home the topgallants!"
Manthir commanded.
"Sheet home!"
the officer in charge of each mast echoed.
"Ease the bunt lines and clue lines!"
the pinrail captains commanded, and the topgallant sails fell like vast curtains, billowing above the already drawing topsails as the powerful wind filled them.
"Haul around on the sheets!"
Dreadnought leaned harder to the press of her increased canvas as her topgallants were braced round. She drove across the beam sea in sharp white explosions of spray, and her starboard gun ports dipped closer to the water. But the same increased angle of heel lifted her weather gun ports higher, and she bore down upon the galleys ahead of her like a stooping hawk. A final broadside from her starboard guns slammed into the galley to leeward, and Caleb looked astern. Destroyer was setting her own topgallants to match the flagship, and beyond her, above the billows of smoke as she fired into the same hapless galley, he could see more canvas blossoming from the other ships in his column. He glanced at Merlin with a tight, kraken-like grin, then turned back to the south as Captain Manthir altered course very slightly to bring his port guns to bear on yet another Doloran galley. Gavin Martin, Baron Whiteford, stood like a statue atop King Gorja II's aftercastle. Captain Kaylee stood beside him, and both of them stared up to the north. The Tarosian galleys had been leading the combined fleet, and King Gorja II was near the head of the entire formation. Whiteford was too far south to see clearly what was happening, but his lookouts left him in little doubt of the totality of the disaster.
"How did they do it, my lord?"
Kaylee muttered beside him, and the Baron shrugged.
"I have no idea, Gilbert," he admitted candidly. "But how they did it doesn't really matter at the moment, does it?"
"No, my lord," Kaylee agreed grimly, and turned to look at his admiral.
Whiteford continued gazing northward. The wind carried the intermittent rumble of the heavy cannonade to him, and the sound was growing both steadily and louder as it drew closer. His lookouts had reported many galleons, but he wasn't quite certain they had seen all of them yet. If Harald of Caris had run the insane risk of sending any of his galleons this far from Rockshoal Bay, he would have sent all of them. And just from the weight of fire Whiteford could hear, they had to be steadily reducing the Doloran ships astern of him to wreckage. He looked up at the sky. The sun had moved well to the west of noon, and the clouds which had hovered on the eastern horizon earlier in the day were sweeping steadily and rapidly closer. Indeed, their outriders were already overhead. More rain, he thought, soon. And judging by how quickly it was coming on, the wind was going to increase still further as well. He turned and looked to the west. Crag Hook, the finger of rocky cliffs reaching out to the southwest to shelter Crag Reach, was broad on his starboard beam, and he felt a deep, burning temptation to alter course. If he passed between Crag Hook and Opal Island into the sheltered waters of the Reach, his ships would be protected from the weather rolling in from the west,
And in those sheltered waters, they'd be able to maneuver under oars, able, in theory at least, to give a better account of themselves against the vengefully pursuing galleons. But...
"We'll hold our course,"
he said, responding to Kaylee's unasked question.
"And we'll shake out a reef as well."
Protest hovered behind the flag captain's eyes, and Whiteford's bark of laughter was harsh.
"It's tempting,"
he admitted, waving his right arm at the passage into Crag Reach.
"It's very tempting, and I know I'm risking the ship by increasing sail in this wind, but if we take shelter in the Reach, they'll either come straight in after us or hover off Opal Island to keep us penned up like sheep until they're ready to attack. And when they do, those guns of theirs will chop us up for kraken bait."
Kaylee looked rebellious, and Whiteford shook his head.
"I know what you're thinking, Gilbert, but listen to that."
The wind brought the thunder of cannon to them more clearly, and the Baron grimaced.
"They don't just have more guns. They're firing them much more rapidly as well. It's the only explanation for how they can be producing that much fire. And,"
he smiled grimly,
"it also explains why they were putting so many guns aboard galleons in the first place, doesn't it?"
"Yes, my lord, I suppose it does."
Kaylee's look of rebellion faded, but one of deep concern remained, and Whiteford understood perfectly. They were still almost 250 miles north of Cape Ruin, and there was no protected anchorage between Crag Reach and Demon Bay.
"I imagine we're going to lose some more galleys, if the wind makes up the way it looks like it's going to,"
the Baron said unflinchingly.
"But bad weather will make it harder for them to run any more of us down, and we'll have a better chance against the sea than we will against that."
He jerked his head back to the north, and finally, slowly, his flag captain nodded, not just in acceptance, but in agreement.
"Yes, my lord," he said. "Good, Gilbert."
Whiteford laid one hand lightly on Kaylee's shoulder, then inhaled deeply.
"And make a signal to all ships in company to make more sail as well."
4. HMS Dreadnought, off Armageddon Reef.
"Secure the guns, Captain," Crown Prince Caleb said.
"Aye, aye, sir," Captain Manthir replied. "Master Sadler, secure the guns."
"Aye, aye, sir."
Lieutenant Benjamin Sadler was Dreadnought's second lieutenant, but he was acting as first. Lieutenant Gerard was among the ship's 19 wounded. All along the ship, bone-weary seamen ran the guns in one last time, cautious with their 2-ton charges on the pitching deck. Handspikes under the cascabels heaved up, depressing the guns' muzzles, until the loaded round shot rolled out onto the deck, pushing the wads before them. Then hook-headed staffs were used to extract the powder cartridges before the guns were wormed to scrub away the worst of the built-up powder fouling and vent holes were thoroughly cleaned. Gun captains inspected the pieces carefully, then tampions and vent aprons were replaced and they were hauled back up to the closed gun ports and secured for sea. While the gun crews worked, Caleb strode to the taffrail and looked astern. Destroyer still forged along in Dreadnought's wake. She'd fallen farther astern. At 600 yards, the interval between them had grown to twice what it had been at the start of the action, but she was making up the lost ground steadily. It was hard to make out very much beyond her. The setting sun was invisible beyond the thick cloud cover, foam was beginning to blow in streaks, and what had begun as gusting showers of rain was turning into a steady downpour. The sails of destroyers next astern were dimly visible through the rain and spray, but the ship herself was impossible for Caleb to identify, and he couldn't see the other ships of his column at all. The Crown Prince turned his head as Merlin stepped up beside him. Lieutenant Falcon stood between them and the rest of the quarterdeck, affording them privacy and serving as a discreet suggestion to others that they should do the same.
"Are they all still back there?"
Caleb asked. He had to raise his voice to a near shout to carry through the tumult of rain, wind, creaking timbers, and waves.
"Not quite,"
Merlin raised his own voice as he gazed out into the darkening rain. But his eyes were unfocused as he studied not Destroyer, but the overhead imagery Owl was feeding him from his snark.
"The column's not as neat as it was. Dagger and Dreadful are sailing almost abreast, and most of the ships have changed their relative positions. All of them left the line at some point to deal with a cripple or someone trying to run, and Damsel and Torrent never managed to rejoin. They're making for Samuel Island, but we didn't lose any of them. The other 12 all got back into formation somehow, and they're still back there." "I can hardly believe it," Caleb confessed.
He turned to look forward along Dreadnought's decks.
"I mean, I knew the new guns were going to give us a tremendous advantage, but still—"
His voice trailed off. Merlin nodded, but his expression was shadowed with more than rain and spray.
"We may not have actually lost a ship, but didn't get off scot-free," he pointed out,
and it was Caleb's turn to nod grimly. Dreadnought herself had taken 16 hits, 9 of them from guns at least as heavy as her own. She'd been hulled below the waterline twice, but the carpenter and his assistants had hammered wooden shot plugs into the holes to stop the leaks. One of her foredeck carronades had been dismounted, and most of its crew had been killed by the same hit. Another round shot had taken a bite out of her mainmast. That, fortunately, had been a glancing hit, and before he'd been wounded, Lieutenant Gerard had fished the wounded portion of the mast by lashing spars into place to stiffen it, like a splint on a broken arm. The port anchor had been shot away as well, and there were dozens of new splices in the running rigging, not to mention holes in almost every one of her sails. But despite all that, and despite her 17 dead and 19 wounded, the majority cut down by flying splinters, she was in incredibly good shape. Other galleons, Merlin knew, had been less fortunate. HMS Typhoon, from the original experimental squadron, in Admiral Stainair's column, had found herself running along between two particularly ably handled Tarosian galleys. She'd hammered both of them into wrecks, but a lucky hit from their own artillery had cut her mainmast no more than a dozen feet above the deck. Worse, the collapsing mast had fallen across the Tarosian to leeward, and the surviving members of the galleon's crew had stormed across the tangle of fallen spars in a desperate boarding attempt. It had failed, amid horrendous casualties inflicted in no small part by the flintlock muskets and bayonets of Typhoon's 80 Marines. But it had inflicted even more losses on Typhoon's company as well. The galleon's total casualties amounted to over 200, better than half her total ship's company, and she'd lost contact with the rest of Stainair's column. But Captain Stewart was still on his feet, despite having suffered a minor wound of his own during the boarding attempt, and he had the situation under control. Despite the damage to her masts and rigging, she was still seaworthy, and he was conning her carefully through the rain and steadily rising wind towards the prearranged rendezvous off Samuel Island, where the two supply ships awaited the rest of the fleet. Very few of Caleb's ships were undamaged, but none of the others had been as badly hurt as Typhoon. In fact, Dreadnought's damages were worse than most, probably because she'd been at the head of her column.
"What can you tell me about Dominic and the other side?" Caleb asked,
leaning closer until their heads were only inches apart. He still had to raise his voice to be heard through the noise of wind and sea, but not even Arnald Falcon could have overheard him, and this time Merlin turned his head to look at him levelly. He raised one eyebrow, and Caleb showed his teeth in a tight grin.
"It's a bit late for either of us to be pretending you need to withdraw to your quarters and meditate, Merlin," he said, eyes flickering with humor.
"All right," Merlin agreed, then stroked one of his mustachios thoughtfully for a moment.
"Traveler and Summermoon are waiting at the rendezvous with Intrepid," he said, beginning with the supply ships and their escorting schooner. "All the other schooners are still in good shape, but they're worrying more about the weather than anything else right now. I imagine most of them will make for Samuel Island, too, as soon as they can. Dominic's column is pretty much intact. Typhoon, Thunderbolt, and Maelstrom have all gotten separated from his formation. They're proceeding independently to Samuel Island, like Damsel and Torrent, but the others are still in company with him. Dominic himself is still in action with the trailers from Whiteford's formation, but I think at least 10 or 12 of the Tarosians are going to evade him in this stuff." He waved an arm at the weather. "Whiteford's leading them, and he's driving them awfully hard for these conditions. He's also well past Cape Ruin. I think he's making for Dexter Point at the moment, but whether he's thinking in terms of Demon Reach or continuing to run, I couldn't say. There's another 5 or 6 galleys to the east," he continued, gesturing at the almost pitch-dark eastern horizon, and his expression was grim. "2 of them are pretty badly damaged. I don't think they'll survive the night. The others may, but 2 of them are Dolorans, and they're already in trouble." He paused for a moment, staring off into the darkness where the men crewing those galleys fought for their lives against the hunger of the sea beyond even the sight of his eyes, then looked back at Caleb. "Earl Thirsk's in command of what's left," he said. "He's got about 60 galleys and all the remaining store ships, and he's rounding Crag Hook right this minute. He'll be safely anchored in Crag Reach within another 2 or 3 hours." "I see," Caleb frowned, staring at nothing while he considered what Merlin had told him. He stayed that way for several seconds, then looked back at Merlin. "What's our own current position?" he asked. "So now I'm your navigator as well, am I?" Merlin retorted with a smile. "When a wizard or a Seijin appears to offer you his services, you might as well take full advantage of them," Caleb replied with another of those tight grins. "Well, for your information, we're about 33 miles south-southeast of the northern tip of Opal Island. And is Thirsk anchoring behind Crag Hook or in the lee of Opal?" "Behind Crag Hook," Merlin replied.
Caleb nodded again, obviously thinking hard, then grimaced.
"I can't remember the chart well enough," he admitted. "Could we make the passage between Opal and Crag Hook from here in a single tack?"
It was Merlin's turn to frown as he studied the satellite imagery relayed to him from the overhead snark.
"I don't think so," he said after a moment, speaking just a bit more slowly. "The wind's veered too far round." "I was afraid of that. Still, it may be for the best. The men can use the rest."
Merlin turned to face the prince squarely.
"Caleb, you aren't thinking about going into Crag Reach after them tonight, are you?"
"That's exactly what I'm thinking," Caleb said,
and Merlin's frown deepened.
"Caleb, you've got only 13 ships. Assuming none of the others lose contact on the way, and you're talking about threading a needle in the dark. The passage between Opal and Crag Hook is barely 22 miles wide. It's raining hard. Night's falling. The wind's still rising. We've got 16-foot seas, and every depth your chart show is 800 years out of date."
"Agreed," Caleb said calmly. "On the other hand, according to the charts, the main channel's over 9 miles wide and almost 60 feet deep until you're past the northern tip of the island. Things may have changed since Hastings created the original charts, but there should be enough margin to let us in." In the middle of a rainy night? Merlin demanded. Without waiting for Dominic or any of the stragglers? We'll lose at least a couple of days making rendezvous with Dominic and then getting back into position, Caleb pointed out. Which doesn't change the fact that it's going to be darker than the inside of a barrel by the time we can get there. Your lookouts won't even be able to see Crescent Island, much less avoid running into it. Ah, but I have the aid of a wizard, don't I, Sijin Merlin? Caleb replied softly. You can see Crescent Island, and probably Opal Island and Crag Hook all at the same time. So, Dreadnought will take the lead, and the others will follow in our wake. But why run the risk of having one of them go astray? Merlin argued. If one of our galleons goes ashore in weather like this, we'll probably lose her entire company, and Thirsk isn't going anywhere, certainly not before daylight. No, he isn't, Caleb agreed. But I'll tell you what he is going to be doing. Merlin raised both eyebrows, and Caleb shrugged. He's going to be putting springs on his anchor cables. He's going to be ferrying as many of his heavy guns as he can ashore and setting them up as shore batteries. He's going to be thinking about what we did to him and thinking about the fact that Crag Reach is a lot better suited to his galleys than the open sea was. And he's going to be doing everything he can to offset his men's panic and shock. He's going to use every single day, every hour we give him, to make arrangements to kill as many of my men as he can when we finally attack. But, Merlin began, and Caleb shook his head. I know that if we wait for Dominic, we can still destroy every ship Thirsk has, whatever he does in the meantime. But if we give him the time to prepare, we're going to lose ships of our own. Nowhere near as many as he will, I'm sure, but we'll be forced to come to him on far less favorable terms, and there's no way he'll give in without a fight. Probably a nasty one at such close quarters. On the other hand, if we go in tonight, while his men are still exhausted and terrified, while he himself is probably still trying to grapple with what we've already done to him, the momentum will all be on our side. His men will feel trapped and helpless, and men who feel that way are a lot more likely to simply surrender instead of fighting to the bitter end. Merlin had started to open his mouth in fresh protest, but now he closed it. He still thought Caleb's scheme was risky, but he had to admit the prince appeared to have adjusted quite nicely to the notion that the more-than-human abilities of his Seijin, or wizard, were there to be used. And, given Merlin's own capabilities, the notion of entering Crag Reach in the middle of a near gale wasn't quite as insane as it had appeared at first glance. Yet that wasn't what chopped off his protest. No, what did was the realization Caleb was right. It wasn't really something which would have occurred to Nemu Alban, for there'd been no surrenders in the war she'd fought. There'd been only victors and the dead, and the very concept of quarter had been meaningless. Merlin had allowed for the effects of demoralization and panic on the combat capability of the enemy, but he hadn't gone the one step further and remembered that honorable surrender was a deeply enshrined part of Seifoldian warfare. And, he admitted to himself, he'd been too concerned with the potential difficulties of simply penetrating Crag Reach to consider how terrifying a night attack in a secure anchorage must be. Especially on a night such as this one promised to be, and on the heels of the sort of nightmare day the men on the receiving end of it had just endured. It was still a questionable decision, he reflected. It could be argued either way, and rightfully so. Yet he was coming to suspect that Caleb Armok would always prefer the more audacious solution to almost any problem. That could be a bad thing, but only if the prince allowed his instincts to overrule his cold calculation of potential advantages and disadvantages. And despite Merlin's initial reaction, that wasn't what was happening here.
It looks like he's inheriting more than just a throne from his father, Merlin thought, remembering Harald's cool, calculating response to the horrendous odds against his kingdom. I wonder if there's a gene for this sort of thing. All right, Your Highness, he said finally, his tone rather more formal than had become the norm. If you're determined to do this, I suppose the least your tame wizard can do for you is help. That's the spirit, Caleb said, smacking him on the water-streaming backplate of his cuirass, and turned to look over his own shoulder. Captain Manthe, general signal. Form line astern of me. Prepare for night action. Repeat to all units. Then let's get our night lights lit and hoisted while we've still got a little daylight. After that, he bared his teeth at the flag captain, I want you to change course. 5. Crag Reach, Armageddon Reef. Earl Thirsk stifled a groan of pure exhaustion as he lowered himself into the chair. His belly rumbled with a sudden sharp pang as the aroma of the hot food his valet had managed to put together reminded him he hadn't eaten since breakfast, the better part of 36 hours ago. He started to reach for his wine glass, then stopped, and his mouth twitched wryly. The last thing he needed on a completely empty stomach was wine, and he picked up a large buttered roll instead. He bit into it, and at that instant it was the most delicious thing he had ever tasted. He forced himself to chew slowly, savoring it rather than wolfing it down like a half-starved slash lizard, then swallowed with a sigh of pleasure. He leaned forward, gathering up his fork and knife, and cut a piece of the broiled mutton on his plate. It followed the roll into his mouth, and he closed his eyes, chewing blissfully. It was a small enough pleasure after a day like this one, he thought, and swallowed. He allowed himself a small sip of wine, and grimaced as it washed the mutton down. He didn't know even exactly how many ships he still had under his command. The best estimate he'd been able to put together was that there were between 45 and 80, including what he thought were all the surviving supply ships. That wasn't very much out of a combined fleet which had numbered over 170 only that morning. He forked up a steaming bite of buttered potato, although the food suddenly seemed less tasty despite his hunger, and he contemplated the day's endless chain of disasters. He didn't know how many of the other ships of the fleet had actually been lost, but he knew the number was high. He'd personally seen King Ronald's corpse-littered wreck and the wave-washed bodies floating away from it just before the shattered hulk rolled over and sank. He'd seen the funeral pyres of at least a dozen ships billowing up where they'd either taken fire in the midst of combat or been set ablaze by the Carizians. He hoped the enemy had at least allowed their crews to take to any surviving boats before firing their ships behind them, but he wasn't even certain of that. He paused a moment, then shook his head, irritated with himself.
Yes, you know they did allow the crews of at least some of their prizes to abandon first, he told himself. Hell, you've got over 190 survivors aboard Gorath Bay alone.
Which was true enough, but the number his own ship had picked up only underscored all of the hundreds, thousands of other men who'd been aboard Malachi's other galleys. He cut another piece of mutton and put it in his mouth, chewing methodically. He'd seen nothing but sinking wrecks and blazing hulls as his flagship sailed along in the wake of the running battle. The Carizian galleons appeared to have left no surviving galleys behind them. They'd been twice as fast as his own ships, especially after they'd set their topgallants, and they'd used that speed to chase down their prey relentlessly, steadily overtaking and sinking every galley in their path. There'd been nothing at all he could do about that, but it was probably just as well they'd been too fast for him to catch, he told himself grimly, remembering the old story of the hunting hound who'd caught the slash lizard? He shook his head again, this time in still stunned shock. The survivors Gorath Bay had picked up had confirmed what he'd already realized. Somehow, the Carizians had figured out a way to fire heavy cannon 3 or 4 times as rapidly as anyone else in the world. He was still trying to get his mind wrapped around the consequences that implied for the art of naval war, but Prince Caleb and several of the survivors had identified the Carizian Crown Prince's flag aboard one of those deadly galleons, had delivered a brutal demonstration that those consequences would be profound. At least Thirsk had managed to get the ship still in company with Gorath Bay into the shelter of Crag Hook. Even here, behind the stony barrier of the curved headland, his flagship jerked and snubbed harshly, uneasily at her anchor. Pelting rain drummed on the skylight overhead and ran gurgling off the decks and through the scuppers, and he could hear the wind whining in the galley's shrouds and lifting blowing spray. The lamps swayed on their gimbals above him, flooding the familiar comfort of his great cabin with warm light, and he remembered other nights. Remembered sitting here, smoking his pipe, enjoying a cup of wine or a tankard of beer, warm and comfortable, and made even more aware of it by the sound of rain or the sigh of wind. But there was no comfort tonight. There was only the awareness that he'd won no more than a breathing space. Caleb would deduce where he was without any difficulty. And, having deduced it, he would do something about it. From the survivors' stories and his own observations, he doubted very much that Caleb had lost more than 1 or 2 of his galleons at most. The young Carizian prince had just won what was undoubtedly the greatest, most one-sided naval victory in history, and, unlike Malachi, Caleb was a seaman. The Royal Carizian Navy knew about finishing the tasks to which it set its hand, and the prince was unlikely to pass up the opportunity to make his victory complete. Within a day or two, Thirsk would see those galleons standing into Crag Reach. It would be his turn to see his ships shot to pieces in front of his eyes.
"But they won't win as cheaply against us as they did against Malachi," he promised himself.
He'd already issued orders for every galley to rig springs to their anchor cables as soon as it was daylight. The springs, hawsers let out of gun ports and attached to the ship's anchor cables at one end and to their capstans at the other, would allow any of his ships to turn in place by simply winding the hawser around the capstan. It would enable them to aim their guns in any direction, which was about the best he could hope to do. His artillery still wouldn't be able to fire as quickly as Caleb's obviously could, but Caleb wouldn't be able to bring all of his firepower to bear simultaneously either.
"And next time," Thirsk thought grimly, "what he can do to us won't come as a complete surprise either."
He stabbed his fork into another potato and bared his teeth. As soon as it was light, he would start putting parties ashore to find suitable spots for shore batteries as well. It wasn't going to be easy, but he was confident he could find at least some, and given the steepness of the hillsides rising beyond the beach, probably high enough to give his guns greater reach. Once they were in place, the price Caleb would pay for any victory would climb steeply. It was even possible, he told himself, that if he could make the probable price high enough, Caleb might decline to pay it. After all, he'd already shattered this prong of the Allies' planned offensive, and his galleons had to represent a huge part of Karras's total naval strength. Given the choice between heavy losses in return for the destruction of an already defeated foe, or returning with his own ships intact to support the rest of the Carizian Navy against the combined forces of Coruscant, Emerald, and Chisholm, he might well choose the latter.
"And you really want to convince yourself of that, don't you, Lewis?" he told himself with a sour snort.
He swallowed yet another bite of potato, then blinked in groggy surprise as he realized it was the last bite. He'd also managed to consume the entire thick slice of mutton and the side of green peas. And, he discovered, peering into the empty breadbasket, at least another 3 rolls. He laughed and shook his head tiredly. Clearly, he was even more exhausted than he thought he was, and it was time he got some desperately needed sleep.
"Things may not look any better in the morning," he thought, "but at least a few hours of sleep on a full belly will leave me in better shape to deal with them."
He finished the glass of wine, stood, and stumbled off to his sleeping cabin.
6. HMS Dreadnought, off Armageddon Reef. Merlin of Thrawes stood in the mizzenmast ratlines, 8 feet above the quarterdeck, and peered into the darkness. The wind, as he'd predicted, had continued to rise, but it actually seemed to be tapering off slightly now. It was down to only about 34 miles per hour, but the rain was even heavier than it had been earlier. Even his artificial eyes couldn't see very far through the almost solid wall of rain and spray. It was a pity, he thought, that Pika's didn't come equipped with radar. Still, he supposed it would have been a bit much to put radar emitters powerful enough to do him much good under these conditions into Pika's intended to wander around the environs of a high-tech civilization. "Owl," he subvocalized, climbing back down to the deck and grasping one of the lifelines rigged across it.
"Yes, Lieutenant Commander?"
"I need that imagery now." There was no response, and Merlin grimaced.
"Begin feeding the previously specified imagery," he said, quite a bit more snappishly.
"Yes, Lieutenant Commander," the AI replied, totally unperturbed by his tone, and a detailed see-through schematic blinked into existence across his field of view.
Unlike Merlin's eyes, the Snark's sensors were perfectly capable of penetrating the stormy darkness, and Merlin felt an undeniable surge of relief as he saw the icons of all 13 of Caleb's galleons. Precisely how the merely mortal lookouts aboard any one of those ships had been able to keep sight of the poop lanterns and the additional lanterns suspended from the mizzen peak of the ship in front of them was more than Merlin was prepared to explain. But somehow they'd done it. Now it was up to him to get them into the sheltered waters of Crag Reach. He considered the schematic's terrain imagery. It looked as if Dreadnought was just about on the proper heading, but just about wasn't nearly good enough. "Owl," he subvocalized once more.
"Yes, Lieutenant Commander."
"Add current wind vector and course projections for Dreadnought to the imagery and update continuously."
"Yes, Lieutenant Commander."
The requested arrows and dotted line appeared effectively instantaneously, and Merlin snorted. Then he made his way across the steeply tilted, pitching quarterdeck, moving hand over hand along the lifeline, to where Caleb stood with Captain Manthir besides the helmsman. There were 2 men on the wheel, and a 3rd seaman stood ready to lend his weight as well if it should prove necessary. Manthir really should have been getting some rest of his own, Merlin thought, but the flag captain hadn't even considered the possibility. Dreadnought was his ship. Everything about her was his responsibility, and now that he'd seen to the immediate needs of his men, he was undoubtedly standing there silently praying that his crown prince wasn't quite as insane as he seemed. Merlin's mouth quirked at the thought, but perhaps he was doing the captain an injustice. What Caleb had accomplished already this day, with, of course, Merlin's modest assistance, seemed to have given every man aboard the flagship a near idolatrous faith in the prince's seaman's instinct. If he wanted to sail them straight towards a cliff-girt lee shore in the middle of a midnight gale, they were prepared to do just that, although Manthir obviously intended to stay right here and personally keep an eye on the entire process. Caleb himself appeared totally unworried by anyone's possible concerns about his mental stability. The prince's feet were spread wide apart as he clung to another lifeline for balance with his right fist, and he draped an oilcloth poncho over his cuirass and mail. The wind whipped the loose fall of the poncho. Rain and spray ran from the rim of his Morian-like helmet like a waterfall, and the light gleaming up from the binnacle's illuminated compass card lit his face from below. There were lines of fatigue in that face, and his cheekbones were gaunt, etched against the tight skin, yet his mouth was firm and confident, and the glow in his brown eyes did not come solely from the binnacle light. He might, Merlin realized, be a very young man, but this was the sort of a moment for which he'd been born. Caleb looked up at his approach, and Merlin leaned close, half shouting in his ear, "We're pointing too high! The wind's backed a little to the east, and we need to come about a point and a half to leeward!" Caleb nodded, and Merlin walked over to where Arnald Falcon stood, half his body illuminated by the glow of the great cabin skylight, watching Caleb's back even here. Caleb waited several minutes, then bent deliberately over the binnacle, squinting at the compass. He straightened and gazed up at the set of the barely visible sails, then stood in obvious thought for a second or two before he turned to Manthir. No one could possibly have heard what he said to the flag captain, but the conversation lasted only a minute or so. Then Manthir leaned close to his helmsman.
"Make your course southwest by west,"
he bawled through the tumult.
"Aye, aye, sir,"
the senior helmsman shouted back.
"Southwest by west it is."
He and his companion eased the wheel, spoke by spoke, eyes locked to the compass card. Holding an exact heading under any conditions was impossible for any sailing vessel. In this weather there wasn't any point even trying, but they were highly experienced helmsmen. They'd stick as close to it as anyone could, and Merlin smiled in satisfaction as Dreadnought's projected track extended directly into the deep water channel north of Opal Island between Crag Hook and the much smaller Crescent Island. Or, he reminded himself, into what was a deep water channel 800 years ago, at least.
"He did that well."
Merlin turned to look at Falcon as the marine shouted in his ear. They could see one another's faces clearly in the glow of the skylight, and Merlin raised one eyebrow.
"Who did what well?"
he asked.
"Caleb,"
Falcon replied with a grin. He wiped water from his face and shook his head.
"Those men will never guess you gave him the course correction." "I don't know what you're talking about,"
Merlin replied as innocently as anyone could under the current conditions of wind and sea.
"Oh, of course not, Sigyn Merlin,"
Falcon agreed with an even broader grin, and Merlin laughed. Then he sobered.
"You're right, he did do it well,"
he shouted back.
"And that's more important than ever." "Agreed,"
Falcon nodded vigorously. Then he glanced at the prince, and his smile was deeply approving.
"He's growing up, isn't he?"
he said to Merlin.
"That he is,"
Merlin agreed.
"That he is."
Falcon was right, he reflected, and in more ways than one. Caleb had already demonstrated his own tactical and strategic insight, and also his willingness to back his own evaluation of a situation. He wasn't deferring to Merlin's suggestions, not unless he happened to agree with them, at least. He was using Merlin's abilities, then making his own decisions. And the young man was showing an impressive attention to detail as well. He deliberately sailed further east than he had to before turning back towards Armageddon Reef. He'd added at least 2 more hours to the total transit time, and Captain Manthir had used that time to get the galley fires relit and feed every man as much hot soup, stew thick with rice and vegetables, as he could eat. It was impossible to estimate how much that hot food was going to mean to men who'd already had an exhausting day and faced an even more exhausting night. But Manthir had also managed to give each man at least 2 hours in his hammock as well.
Dreadnought seamen and marines would be going back into combat as well-fed and rested as they could possibly be, and the captain had even managed to rig canvas scoops to gather rainwater to replenish their water tanks, then ordered the cooks to prepare gallons of hot tea before they doused the galley fires once more. The men aboard Dreadnought recognized all of that, and word had gotten around that the prince had deliberately given them the time for it. That was the sort of consideration and preparation they weren't going to forget. Those of them who survived the night, at least.
7. Crag Reach, Armageddon Reef.
"Thank Langhorne we're not out in that,"
Lieutenant Roger Bladen observed, listening to the storm. It was blacker than the inside of a boot, but the regular savage pounding of the heavy surf on the far side of Crag Hook and Opal Island could be heard even through the wind and rain. Of course, the wind, like the waves, was far weaker here, inside the sheltered waters of Crag Reach. Not that those waters were precisely what Bladen would have called calm. The anchorage was deep, with its walls rising sheer-sided out of the water, especially on its eastern side, where deep water ran to the very foot of the 100-foot cliff which formed Crag Hook's western face. On the western side, the shore was less vertical, and the water shoaled much more sharply. There were actually some smallish rocky beaches in pockets scalloped out of the feet of the steep hills on that side. But the shallower water was also rougher, and most of the fleet's captains had opted to anchor further out, in deeper water which gave them more safety room if their ship should happen to drag their anchors. Bladen's ship, the Royal Bedard, had been one of the last galleys to reach safety. Visibility had been worse than bad by the time she arrived, and she'd collided with her consort, Royal Champion, on their way into the reach, losing one of her bow anchors in the process. Given her late arrival and the gathering darkness, she'd been forced to find the best spot to anchor she could, effectively on her own, and her captain had felt his cautious way as far into the reach as he dared, then dropped his remaining bow anchor. As a result, she was one of the southernmost of the huddled fleet ships, and also one of the furthest east, separated from Paladin, the next nearest galley, by about 120 yards. She was well into the lee of Crag Hook, but more exposed than many of the other ships, and even now she seemed to jerk nervously, as if frightened by the fury of the weather outside the anchorage, as she snubbed and rolled to her single anchor.
"I didn't realize you were so devout, Roger," Neville Meredith said in response to his remark.
He and Bladen stood sheltering from the wind and rain in the lee of the forecastle, at the foot of the starboard forecastle ladder. Meredith was Royal Bedard's first lieutenant, while Bladen, who just completed a personal check of the anchor watch, was the galley's second lieutenant. The first lieutenant was due to relieve him as an officer of the watch in another 10 minutes or so, after which Bladen would finally be able to stumble below, find something to eat, and get at least a few hours of desperately needed sleep.
"After a day like today," Bladen grimaced at his superior, "every damned man aboard is a hell of a lot more devout tonight than he was this morning."
"Summed up like Grand Vicar Rake himself," Meredith said sardonically.
"Well, would you rather be out there or safe and sound in here?" Bladen demanded, waving one arm in the general direction of the seething white surf invisible through the thick, rainy night.
"That wasn't exactly my point," Meredith replied. "My point was..."
He never completed the sentence. The three-man anchor watch saw it first. They weren't stationed in Royal Bedard's bows as lookouts. They were there solely to keep an eye on the anchor cable, to be sure the galley wasn't dragging and that the cable wasn't chafing, a point which had assumed more than usual importance, given that it was now the only anchor she had. There was a lookout stationed in the galley's crow's nest, but not because anyone, including him, really thought there'd be anything for him to spot. He was there solely because Earl Thirsk had ordered every ship to post lookouts, and the unfortunate seaman in Royal Bedard's crow's nest deeply resented the orders that put him up on that cold, vibrating, rain- and wind-swept perch for absolutely no good reason. He was as wet, chilled to the bone, miserable, and exhausted as anyone else, and his body's need for rest was an anguished craving. He huddled in the crow's nest, his oilskin draped to protect him as much as possible, and concentrated upon simply enduring until he was relieved and could finally collapse into his own hammock. In fairness, even if he'd been fresh and alert, it was unlikely, given the visibility conditions, that he would have seen anything, despite the low range, more than a handful of seconds before the anchor watch did. But that was because HMS Dreadnought had extinguished all of her lanterns and running lights, except for a single shaded poop lantern whose light was directed dead astern. Unfortunately for Royal Bedard, she, like every other vessel anchored with her, and unlike Caleb's flagship, was illuminated by anchor lights, poop lanterns, and lanterns at entry ports. More lights burned below deck, spilling illumination out of stern and quarter windows, out of oar ports, deck hatches, and open scuttles. Despite the darkness and the rain, she wasn't at all hard to see. One of the anchor watch straightened up suddenly, peering into the night as a shadow seemed to intrude between him and Paladin's stern windows, almost due north of his own ship.
"What's that?" he demanded of his fellows.
"What's what?"
one of them retorted irritably. He was no fonder of the weather or any more rested than any of them, and his temper was short.
"That!"
the first man said sharply, as the vague shadow became suddenly much clearer.
"It looks like..."
Captain Gwilym Manthir stood very still by the quarterdeck bulwark. Not a voice spoke as Dreadnought's entire crew waited, poised statue still at its action stations. The captain was aware of the Crown Prince, his Marine Guards, and Lieutenant Athrawes standing behind him, but every ounce of his attention was focused on the lanterns, windows, and scuttles gleaming through the rain. Even now, Manthir could scarcely believe Prince Caleb had brought them unerringly into Crag Reach with the flood tide behind them. The combination of tide, current, and wind had created a wicked turbulence, but the channel between Crag Hook and Opal Island was as broad as their charts had indicated. It was a good thing it was, too. The sudden blanketing effect of Crag Hook's towering height had robbed Dreadnought's sails of power for several minutes before the inrushing tide and her momentum carried her out of its wind shadow. In more cramped waters, that might well have proved fatal, but Caleb had put them in what was, as nearly as Manthir could tell, the exact center of the deep water channel. And now they were about to reap the rewards of the Crown Prince's daring. The captain discovered he was holding his breath and snorted. Did he expect the enemy to hear him breathing, despite the tumult of the storm outside the reach? He grimaced in wry self-amusement, but the thought was only surface deep as his ship crept between the galley so far to the south of the main enemy fleet and the next closest one, 100 or so yards north of her. The gleam of the southern ship's anchor light stood out sharply at her bow, marking her out for his port gunners. Her consort to the north was even more visible, for her stern windows glowed like a brilliant beacon for Manthir's starboard gunners. Another few seconds, he thought, raising his arm slowly, aware of the gun captains crouching behind their weapons in both broadsides. Another few...
Fire!
His right arm went downward, and the darkness came apart in the thunderbolt fury of a double broadside.
It looks like...
The alert seaman never had the chance to finish his observation. A 38-pound round shot came howling out of the sudden gush of smoky flame directly ahead of Royal Bedard and struck him just above the waist. His legs and hips stood upright for an instant, thick blood splashing through the rain. Then they thumped to the deck as the screams began.
"Port your helm!"
Monthyr barked as the smoke-streaming guns recoiled and their crews hurled themselves upon them with swabs and rammers.
"Bring her 2 points to starboard!"
"Aye, aye, 2 points to starboard at ease, Captain!"
"Stand by the stern anchor!"
Lieutenant Bladen recoiled in horror as a screaming round shot ripped into the bows, punched through the break of the forecastle in a cyclone of lethal splinters, and struck Lieutenant Meredith like a demon. The first lieutenant literally flew apart, drenching Bladen in an explosion of hot, steaming blood so shocking he scarcely even felt the sudden flare of agony in the calf of his own right leg. Dreadnought's guns had been double-shotted. The gun crews had prepared with exquisite care, taking the time to be certain everything was done right. Each gun had been loaded with not one round shot, but two, with a charge of grape on top of it for good measure. It decreased accuracy and put a potentially dangerous strain on the gun tubes, but the range was short. Every one of her guns was new, cast to withstand exactly this sort of pressure, and the consequences for their target were devastating. The range was little more than 40 yards, and Dreadnought's gunners might as well have been at target practice. It wasn't physically impossible for them to miss, but it would have been very, very difficult. 27 guns hammered their hate into Royal Bedard with absolutely no warning, no time for the galley to prepare. Her own guns were secured. Her off-duty crew were in their hammocks. Her captain was asleep in his cabin. Her marines were neither armed nor armored. That dreadful avalanche of cast-iron shot came howling out of the heart of the storm like an outrider of hell, almost directly down the center line of the ship, and the carnage it inflicted was unspeakable. Paladin, 30 yards farther away, might have expected to fare better at the greater range, but her lighted stern windows offered an even better target, and far less protection than Royal Bedard's stoutly planked bows. The devastating broadside ripped into her, rending and killing, and the shrieks of the maimed and dying followed on its heels. Louis Gardiner, the Earl of Thirsk, stirred in his sleep at the sudden rumble. He grimaced, not quite waking, his sleeping mind identifying the sound of thunder which might have accompanied any storm, far less one as strong as the one pounding at Armageddon Reef this night. But then it came again, and again. His eyes popped open, and it came again. Dreadnought answered to her helm. She swung to starboard under topsails and headsails alone, streaming smoke from both broadsides as she turned away from Royal Bedard and deeper into the main anchorage. Her long bowsprit thrust into the Doleran formation like a lance, and her starboard battery roared again as she swept around Paladin's port quarter. She pushed between her target and Archangel Schuler, lying almost directly west of her. The two of them, like every other ship in the Doleran force, had been carefully anchored far enough apart to allow them to swing their anchors without risk of collision, and that left ample room for Dreadnought to slide between them. Captain Manthyr stood behind his helmsman, one hand resting on each seaman's shoulder, almost crooning his orders into their ears. He conned his ship with exquisite care, and smoke and thunder jetted from either broadside, blasting into the anchored ships whose crewmen were only just beginning to rouse from exhausted slumber.
Behind her, HMS Destroyer followed her as she threaded her way deeper and deeper into the mass of anchored galleys. And behind Destroyer came Danger and Defense and Dragon.
"All hands stand by to anchor!"
Manthir shouted.
"Stand by to reduce sail!"
Lieutenant Sadler barked through his speaking trumpet, while Midshipman Corby crouched beside the anchor party in the stern.
"Let go the stern anchor!"
Manthir commanded, and Corby echoed the order. The anchor disappeared into the whitecaps, and the cable led aft down the center of her berth deck smoked as it burned across the sill of one of her after gunports.
"Clew down!"
Sadler shouted. The officers in charge of each mast repeated the order, and the seamen at the pinrails eased the halyards, lowering the topsails yards into their lifts and spilling their wind. Other seamen tended the bunt lines and leech lines as the yard came down, and Sadler watched closely.
"Round in the lee brace! Clew up the topsails!"
The canvas disappeared as the hands on the clew lines hauled it up to the yards and belayed. More men on the foredeck took in the jibs while the anchor hawser ran out, and the ship came to a stop as the flukes of her anchor dug into the bottom of Crag Reach.
"Clamp on the spring!"
Manthir ordered, and Corby's seamen made the already prepared bitter end of the spring cable fast to the anchor hawser just outside the gunport.
"Hands to the after capstan!"
the captain shouted, and the seamen previously detailed went running to the capstan to take tension on the spring. Earl Thirsk stumbled out of his cabin into the rain, barefoot, wearing nothing but his breeches, as still more cannon began to thunder. He hurled himself up the ladder to the top of the aftercastle, ignoring the icy water sluicing over his naked torso as he stared in horrified disbelief at the savage flashes lighting up the rain. It was a sight such as no Safeholdian had ever seen before. The Carizian cannon rumbled and roared, the muzzle flashes impossibly long and brilliant in the darkness. Smoke gouted, fuming up in sulphurous clouds reeking of Shanwe's own brimstone. Each muzzle flash etched every plunging raindrop against the night like rubies or diamonds of blood, and the banks of smoke towered up, lit from below, like the fumes above erupting volcanoes. And there was nothing at all the Earl of Thirsk could do about it. Royal Bedard lurched as yet another galleon, the sixth, Lieutenant Bladen's cringing mind thought, swept slowly past her bow, cannon thundering. The lieutenant stood at the top of the port forecastle ladder. The starboard ladder was a shattered ruin, like the mast whose broken stump stood 10 feet off the deck, clinging to the forecastle rail for support, and the calf of his right leg had been laid open by a splinter as if by a sword. He felt hot blood sheeting down his leg, but ignored it as he ignored the rain, while he shouted encouragement to the seamen trying to get two of the galley's bow chasers loaded, despite the round shot howling around their ears. But then he smelled the smoke. Not powder smoke, rolling on the rain-slashed wind from the enemy guns, but a far more terrifying smoke, the smoke of burning wood. His head snapped around, and he blanched in fresh horror. The severed mast had fallen across the decks at an angle, draping the broken yard and its burden of sodden canvas across the midship's hatch. But now smoke billowed up out of the half-blocked hatch, funneling through the fallen rigging and wreckage, thickening into a dense, flame-lit pillar as it streamed up around the yard and mast. He didn't know what had happened. Most likely, one of those lighted lanterns below decks had been shattered, spilling flaming oil across the decks. Or it could have been an accident by one of the powder monkeys trying to carry ammunition to the guns. It might even have been a flaming wad hurled out of one of the Carizian cannon. But it didn't really matter how it had started.
wooden ship's worst enemy wasn't the sea, it was fire. Built of seasoned timbers, painted inside and out, caulked with pitch, rigged with tarred cordage, they were tinderboxes awaiting a spark, even in this sort of weather, and Royal Bedard's spark had been supplied. Under other circumstances, the fire might have been fought, might have been contained and extinguished, but not under these circumstances. Not while Roundshot continued to crash through the ship's hull, mangling and disemboweling terrified crewmen whose exhausted brains were still clawing their way out of sleep and into nightmare.
"Abandon ship! Abandon ship!"
Bladen didn't know who'd shouted at first, but there was no fighting the panic it induced. For that matter, there was no point fighting it, and he dragged himself the rest of the way up the ladder and across to the port bulwark. He peered down over it, and his jaw clenched. The galley's boats had been lowered when she anchored, and men were flinging themselves over the side, struggling through the water, trying to reach that at least temporary sanctuary. Bladen turned at the bulwark. One of the gun crews was still fighting to get its weapon loaded, and he limped back over to grab the closest man by the arm.
"Forget it!" he shouted. "There's no time! Over the side, boys!"
The rest of the gun crew stared at him for a moment, wild-eyed. Then they were gone, scrambling over the bulwark. Bladen watched them go, then turned to take one last look around the deck, to be sure everyone was gone or going. Flames were beginning to spurt out of the hatchway. He could feel their heat on his face from here, even through the rain, and he tried to close his ears to the agonized shrieks of men trapped below in that blazing inferno. There was nothing more he could do, and he turned to follow the gun crew, just as a single round shot from a final thundering broadside struck him squarely in the chest. 14 minutes later, the flames reached his ship's magazine. At least 3 of the anchored galleys were on fire now, illuminating the anchorage brightly despite the rain. Merlin stood beside Caleb on Dreadnought's quarterdeck, as the galleon's guns continued to rave at their targets, and the wild vista of destruction all about him dwarfed anything Nemu Alban, who'd warred with the power of nuclear fusion itself, had ever seen with her own eyes. The ship was no longer moving. She was motionless, not as stable as a shoreside fortress in these white-capped waters, perhaps, but close enough to it for the gunners accustomed to the rolling, pitching motion of a ship at sea. Scoring hits on equally anchored targets was child's play for them under these conditions, and their rate of fire was far higher than it would have been from a moving ship's deck. They loaded and fired like automatons, reducing their targets to shattered, broken wrecks. Steam curled from the hot gun tubes between shots, hissing up like tendrils of fog to be whipped away by the wind. The reek of powder smoke, blazing wood, burning tar and cordage raced across the waves in spray-washed banners of smoke, twisted and broken above the whitecaps, starkly silhouetted against the flash of guns and flaming ships. One of the blazing galleys drifted free as her anchor cable burned through. The wind sent her slowly in Dreadnought's direction, not directly towards her, but close enough, wreathed in the fiery corona of her own destruction. Captain Manthir saw her, and his orders sent the capstan around, tightening the spring until the galleon's starboard broadside bore on the fiery wreck. He stood ready to cut his own cable and make sail if necessary, but 3 quick, thunderous broadsides were enough to finish the already sinking galley. She settled on her side in a huge, hissing cloud of steam as water quenched flame, 150 yards clear of his ship, and another snarling cheer of victory went up from his gunners. Royal Bedard exploded. The deafening eruption when the flames reached her magazine dwarfed every other sound, even the brazen voices of the Carisian guns. The tremendous flash seemed to momentarily burn away the spray and rain. It illuminated the bellies of the overhead clouds, flashed back from the vertical western face of Crag Hook, and hurled flaming fragments high into the windy night, like homesick meteors returning to the heavens. The fiery debris arced upward, then crashed back, hissing into extinction as it hit the water, or smashing down on the decks of nearby galleys and galleons alike in cascades of sparks. Crewmen raced to heave the burning wreckage over the side, and here and there small fires were set, but the pounding rain and wind-blown spray had so thoroughly soaked the topsides of both sides' vessels that no ship was seriously threatened. Yet the furious action paused, as if the galley's spectacular, terrifying disintegration had awed both sides into a temporary state of shock. The pause lasted for 2 or 3 minutes, and then it vanished into renewed bedlam as Caleb's gunners opened fire once more. Earl Thirsk stared helplessly at the hellish panorama. He had no idea how long he'd stood on Gorath Bay's aftercastle. It seemed like an eternity, although it couldn't really have been much longer than 2 hours, possibly a bit more. Someone had draped a cloak over his shoulders, he had no idea who, and he huddled inside it, holding it about him, while he gazed upon the final ruin of his command. The Carisians had split into at least 2 columns, or perhaps 3. They were deep inside his anchored formation, firing mercilessly, and everywhere he looked, the rain was like sheets of bloody glass, lit by the glare of burning galleys and flashing artillery. He'd underestimated his enemy. He'd never dreamed Caleb would have the insane audacity to lead an entire fleet of galleons into Crag Reach at night through the fury of a near gale. He still couldn't believe it, even with the devastating evidence burning to the waterline before his very eyes. Royal Bedard was gone, taking her flames with her, but a half dozen of his other ships blazed brightly, and even as he gazed out at the carnage, another kindled. He watched flames shooting up out of its holds, licking up its tarred shrouds, and, silhouetted against the light, he saw crowded boats pulling strongly away from the inferno. As far as he could tell, no Carisian had even been firing at the blazing ship, and his teeth ached from the pressure of his jaw muscles as he realized the crew had deliberately fired their vessel and then abandoned ship rather than face the enemy. He turned away from the sight, only to see another of his as-yet undamaged galleys getting underway, not to close with the enemy, but to row directly towards the western shore of the anchorage. Even as he watched, she drove herself bodily up onto the rocky beach, and her crew flowed over her sides, splashing into the shallow water, stumbling ashore, fleeing into the darkness. Part of him wanted to curse them for their cowardice, but he couldn't. What else could anyone have expected? Destruction was upon them all, appearing out of the night like the work of some demon, and were they not anchored in the waters of Armageddon Reef itself? That was the final straw, he thought. This very land was cursed. Every single one of his men knew the story of the monumental evil which had been birthed here so long ago and the terrible destruction which had been visited upon it, and that was enough, added to the terror of the totally unexpected attack, the sudden explosion of violence, and their completely unprepared state. Another galley flamed up, fired by its own crew, and a second started moving towards the beach. And a third, and beyond that, silhouetted against the smoky glare of their burning sisters, he saw other galleys hauling down their flags, striking their colors in token of surrender. He stared at them for a moment longer, then turned away. He climbed down the after-castle ladder slowly, like an old, old man, opened his cabin door, and stepped through it. 3. HMS Dreadnought, Crag Reach, Armageddon Reef.
"Earl Thirsk is here, Your Highness," Arnald Falcon announced with unusual formality as he opened the door to HMS Dreadnought's flag cabin. Caleb turned from the vista of white-capped water beyond the stern windows to face the door as his senior marine bodyguard ushered the Dolaran admiral through it.
"Your Highness,"
Thirsk said, bending his head. "My lord," Caleb returned. The Dolaran straightened, and Caleb studied his face thoughtfully. The older man was soaking wet from the rough passage in an open boat, and he looked worn and exhausted, but more than fatigue was stamped upon his features. His dark eyes, Caleb suspected, which were normally confident, even arrogant, carried the shadows of defeat. Yet there was more to it even than that. And the Crown Prince decided Merlin had been right yet again when Caleb explained what he had in mind. Not even this man, confident and strong-minded though he was immune to the reputation and aura of Armageddon Reef, which was going to make this morning's conversation even more interesting.
"I've come to surrender my sword, Your Highness," Thirsk said heavily, as if each word cost him physical pain.
He reached down with his left hand, gripping not the pommel, but the guard of the sword sheathed at his hip. He drew it from its scabbard, ignoring the eagle eye with which both Falcon and Merlin watched him, and extended it to Caleb, hilt first.
"No other man has ever taken my sword from me, Prince Caleb," the Dolaran said, as Caleb's fingers closed upon the hilt.
"It's the sword of a man who deserved a better cause to serve," Caleb replied quietly. He looked down at the weapon in his hand for a moment, then handed it to Falcon, who set it gently on Caleb's desk in turn. The Crown Prince watched Thirsk's face carefully for any reaction to his comment. He thought he saw the Dolaran's lips tighten slightly, but he couldn't be positive. After a moment, he gestured at one of the pair of chairs set ready on opposite sides of the dining table.
"Please be seated, my lord," he invited.
He waited until Thirsk had settled into the indicated chair before seating himself on the opposite side of the table, and Merlin, in his bodyguard's role, moved to stand behind him. A decanter of brandy sat on the linen tablecloth, and the prince personally poured a small measure into each of the two glasses, then offered one to Thirsk. The Dolaran commander accepted the glass, waited for Caleb to pick up his own, and then sipped. He drank very little before he set the glass back on the table, and Caleb smiled wryly as he set his own beside it.
"I've also come, as I'm sure Your Highness has deduced, to discover what surrender terms the remainder of my fleet may expect," Thirsk said in a flattened voice.
Caleb nodded and sat back in his chair. 19 of Thirsk's galleys had been sunk or burned. Another 3 had been battered into shattered, foundering wrecks which had barely managed to beach themselves before they went down. 11 more had struck their colors, and 8 had driven themselves ashore, undamaged, before their crews abandoned them. Yet a third of Thirsk's total warships remained, along with all his supply ships, and Caleb had paid a price of his own for that victory. HMS Dragon had found herself in the path of one of those burning galleys after the Dolaran ship's anchor cable burned through. The blazing wreck had drifted down upon the galleon, and though Dragon had cut her own cable and tried to evade, she'd failed. The two ships had met in a fiery embrace, and both had been consumed in a floating, roaring inferno which had eventually engulfed 2 more of Thirsk's anchored ships.
Over two-thirds of Dragon's company, including her captain and all but one of her lieutenants, had been lost, killed when their ship's magazine exploded, or else drowned before they could be plucked from Crag Reach's waters. Despite that, Thirsk's remaining 21 warships were helpless. Caleb's surviving 12 galleons were anchored in a somewhat ragged line between them and any hope of escape. After what those galleons' guns had already done, none of those galleys' crews, or the admiral in command of them, had any illusions about what would happen if they tried to attack the Carizians or break past them to the open sea. "My terms are very simple, my lord," the Crown Prince said finally. "I will expect the unconditional surrender of every ship in this anchorage." Thirsk flinched, not so much with surprise as in pain.
"I might point out, Your Highness," he said after a moment, "that you don't begin to have sufficient men aboard your ships to take my own as prizes."
"True," Caleb conceded, nodding equably. "On the other hand, I have no intention of taking them with me."
"No?"
Thirsk gazed at him for a moment, then cocked his head.
"Should I assume, then, that you intend to parole them and my surviving men?"
"You should not," Caleb said in a far, far colder voice. "Your king sent his navy to attack the kingdom of Karis in time of peace," he continued in that same icy voice, aware of Merlin standing at his back. "Karis did nothing to offend or harm him in any way. He made no demands upon us, nor did he declare his intent. Instead, like an assassin, he dispatched Duke Malachi and you, my lord, to join with the forces of one of our own allies to treacherously attack a land over 6,000 miles from his own." Surprise, and perhaps a flare of anger at Caleb's biting tone, flickered in Thirsk's eyes, and Caleb snorted. "We weren't as unsuspecting as you and your masters among the Knights of the Temple Lands expected, my lord. Our agents in Tarrow knew all about your plan to attack us. How else do you think we could have known which waters to watch for your approach? And never doubt, Earl Thirsk, that Gorja of Tarrow will pay for his treachery as well. But what matters to us at the moment is that your king neither deserves nor can be trusted to honor any parole you or your men might give. And so, I regret to say, you won't be offered that option." "I trust," Thirsk said through tight lips, "that in that case you aren't so foolish as to believe my men won't attempt to take back their ships from whatever prize crews you may be able to put upon them, Your Highness?" "There will be no prize crews," Caleb informed him. "Your ships will be burned."
"Burned?"
Thirsk gaped in shock.
"But their crews, my men!"
"Your men will be put ashore," Caleb said. "You'll be permitted to land supplies, materials from which shelters may be built, and provisions from your vessels, including your supply ships. You will not be permitted to land any weapons other than woodcutters' axes and saws. Once all of your men are ashore, all of your vessels, except a single unarmed supply ship, will be destroyed. That vessel will be permitted to sail wherever you wish to send it with dispatches for your king."
"You can't be serious!"
Thirsk stared at him, his expression horrified.
"You can't put that many men ashore and simply abandon them! Not here! Not on Armageddon Reef!"
"I'm entirely serious," Caleb replied mercilessly, holding the other man's eyes with his own and letting Thirsk see his angry determination. "You brought this war to us, my lord. Don't pretend for a moment that you were unaware of the plans the Knights of the Temple Lands had for my kingdom's total destruction, and what that would mean for my father's subjects. I can and will put you and your men ashore anywhere I choose, and I will leave them there. Your choice is to accept that, or else return to your flagship and resume the engagement. If, however, you choose the latter course, no further surrenders will be accepted,
and no quarter will be offered."
Merlin stood behind Caleb's chair, his own face an expressionless mask. He heard the absolute unyielding steel in Caleb's voice, and prayed that Thirsk heard it as well. The terms Caleb had offered were the Crown Prince's and no one else's. Merlin had been only slightly surprised by what Caleb had decided to do with Thirsk's surrendered personnel, but he'd felt an inner chill when Caleb explained what he'd intended to do if Thirsk rejected those terms. Now Thirsk gazed at Caleb Armok's unyielding face and recognized the youthful prince's total willingness to do precisely what he just said he would. Caleb might not like it, but he would do it.
"Your Highness," the Earl grated, after a long, tense moment of singing silence, "no commander in history has ever made a threat such as that against enemies who have offered honorable surrender."
"No?" Caleb looked back at him, then showed his teeth in a smile his dynasty's Kraken emblem might have envied, and spoke with cold, deadly precision.
"Perhaps not, my lord. Then again, what other commander in history has discovered that no less than 5 other kingdoms and princedoms have leagued together to destroy his own, when his king's done no harm to any of them? What other commander has known his enemies intend to burn his cities, rape and pillage his people, for no better reason than that someone's offered to hire them like the common footpads they are? I told you our agents in Taro know what your paymasters had in mind, and honorable and generous terms of surrender are for honorable foes, my lord. They are not for hired stranglers, murderers, and rapists."
Thirsk flinched, his face white and twisted, as Caleb's savage words and vicious contempt bit home. But his eyes flickered as well, flickered with the knowledge that those words, however savage, however contemptuous, were also true. Caleb let the silence linger for a full minute, then looked Thirsk squarely in the eye.
"So, now you know the conditions under which your vessels and their crews will be permitted to surrender, my lord. Do you wish to accept them or not?"
Merlin stood with Caleb on Dreadnought's sternwalk, watching as Thirsk's launch rowed away through the still rough waters of Crag Reach.
"You were a bit harsh with him," the man who had once been Nimu Alban observed.
"Yes," Caleb conceded. "I was, wasn't I?"
He turned to face Merlin squarely.
"Do you think I was harsher than he deserved?"
he asked.
It was a serious question, Merlin realized, and he considered it seriously before he responded.
"Actually, I do think you may have been harsher than he deserved," he said after a moment. "Which isn't to say King Ranald didn't deserve everything you said. Although you might want to think about the potential diplomatic consequences of flaying him quite as thoroughly as he deserves.
After what we've done to him, and what he's tried to do to us, I don't really think it's very likely even Father or Rages could negotiate any sort of treaty with him, whatever I said or didn't say," Caleb said with a snort. "Even if Ranild had any desire to forgive and forget, which he won't have, Clintan and the rest of the group of 4 wouldn't let him. And, unlike Karis, Dolar is effectively right next door to the temple, so I might as well tell him what I really think of him."
"I'm sure it was personally satisfying," Merlin said mildly, and Caleb barked a laugh.
"Actually, it was extremely personally satisfying," he corrected. "That wasn't why I did it, though."
Merlin quirked an eyebrow, and the Crown Prince shrugged.
"Thirsk's going to report this conversation when he finally gets home, and when he does, Ronhild's going to be absolutely livid. Well, that was going to happen anyway, no matter how diplomatic I might have been. But now 2 other things are going to happen as well. First,
In the impetuousness of my youth and immature anger, I've let slip the penetration of our agents in Tarot. That should serve as an additional layer of protection for your visions, Merlin. But possibly even more importantly, Ranald, and hopefully the group of four, are going to believe Gorgia was responsible for letting out the information that allowed us to intercept the Southern Force. Either he deliberately fed it to us, or else he was criminally careless, and the fact that the only survivors of this entire debacle are going to be Tarosian galleys may help convince his friends he set the whole thing up intentionally. In either case, it's going to leave him just a tiny bit of a problem, don't you think? Caleb's evil smile made him look remarkably like his father in that moment, Merlin reflected. Second, the Crown Prince continued, what I said to Thirsk and what he's going to repeat to Ranild is going to get out. Don't think for a moment it won't. And when it does, it's going to affect the thinking of all Ranild's nobles. It's also going to get out to all the other rulers of Howard and Haven as well, and I suspect that it's going to make it a bit more difficult for the group of four to arrange a repeat performance of this. They certainly won't be able to approach it as if it were no more than business as usual. And if their next batch of potential cat's paws understand exactly how we're going to regard them, and what can happen to their navies if they lose, it may make them just a bit less eager. Merlin nodded slowly. He wasn't at all certain he agreed with everything Caleb had just said, but the decisiveness it reflected was typical of what he was coming to expect out of the youthful heir to the throne. As far as the effect on Taro and King Gorgia was concerned, he probably had an excellent point, Merlin reflected. It was the other side of it Merlin found worrisome. Yes, it might make it more difficult for the group of four to marshal the forces for their next attack, but the stark ruthlessness of Caleb's expressed attitude might also provoke a matching response from future opponents. Still, Merlin asked himself, how much worse could it get? Caleb's absolutely right about what the group of four wanted to happen to Karis this time. Is it really likely their objectives are going to get less extreme after their tools got hammered this way the first time around? Well, he said aloud, at least Thirsk accepted instead of forcing your hand. Yes, Caleb nodded. And you were right this morning when you suggested offering him the option of putting his men ashore on Opal Island instead of the mainland. Personally, I don't think I'd find putting Crag Reach between me and the demons he expects his people to be so worried about would be all that reassuring. But I'm just as glad they'll find it that way, if it makes them happier about accepting, and means I don't have to kill them all after all.
I'm glad to have been of service, Merlin said dryly. And now that he's accepted, what are your other plans?
Well, Caleb said slowly, turning to look out across the water at the tree-covered slopes of Opal Island's 3,000-plus square miles. I'd really prefer to head back home immediately, but if Typhoon's as badly damaged as you say, she's going to need time for repairs. We've got damage to other ships as well, and all of us used a lot of powder and shot. We need to get Traveler and Summer Moon in here and replenish our ammunition. And I'm thinking that before we burn Thirsk's galleys, we'll strip them of anything we can use as well, especially spare spars, lumber, cordage and canvas, that sort of thing, then stay here long enough to complete at least our major repairs.
Is that wise? Merlin asked in a deliberately neutral tone.
I'll discuss it with Dominic, get his suggestions and advice, of course, Caleb said. But I don't think we have a lot of choice. We can't leave just one or two ships here to repair by themselves, not when Thirsk's going to have several thousand men right here on Opal Island to try something with. So, either we burn our worst damaged ships right along with the galleys, which, much though I don't want to, may turn out to be our best choice,
or else we all stay here long enough to repair them and take them with us when we leave."
The Crown Prince shrugged unhappily.
"I'm not delighted with either option, Merlin, but whatever we do, we're still the better part of a month's hard sail away from Caris. Taking another 5 days or two to make repairs isn't going to add very much to how long it takes us to get home. And, for that matter, Hector and Narmin won't be expecting Malachi for almost another month, anyway. Your own visions say they're still waiting under the original timetable. And they aren't going to be that surprised if Malachi and his fleet are later even than that, not after traveling that far in Dolaran galleys. So, unless Dominic comes up with some compelling argument which hasn't already occurred to me, I think it's more important for us to fully repair all of our surviving galleons than it is to try to get home a couple of 5 days earlier."
March, Year of God, 892. 1. HMS Dreadnought, off Armageddon Reef. Merlin gazed across the hammock nettings as the southern tip of Opal Island passed slowly to port. The schooner Spy led the line of Carisian ships, moving with saucy grace as her more ponderous consorts followed heavily in her wake. The summer sun shone brightly out of a blue sky polished by a handful of fair-weather cumulus clouds, while torrents of the gulls, puffins, and sea wyverns which nested in the cliffs of Crag Hook circled and dove. A gentle surf broke against Sand Islet off the port bow, and the lower line of cliffs leading the way to Bald Rock Head to starboard. Nothing, he thought, could have presented a greater contrast to their arrival in Crag Reach.
"I can't say I'm sorry to be going," Caleb remarked from beside him, and Merlin turned his head to look at the prince. Caleb wore a tunic and trousers, not the armor and helmet he'd worn that violence-racked night, and he ran a hand over his bare head as he, too, looked across at Opal Island. "You do realize this is going to go down as one of the greatest naval battles in the history of the world, don't you?" Merlin said quizzically.
"And rightly so, I suppose," Caleb shrugged. "On the other hand, I did have certain unfair advantages."
He smiled, and Merlin smiled back.
"I do feel sorry for Thirsk, though," Merlin said after a moment, his smile fading. "You were right when you said he deserved a better cause to serve."
"He'd be more likely to find one of those if he'd find a better king," Caleb said tartly. "Trust me, that's something I know a little about."
"Yes, you do."
Merlin turned his eyes back to the island's forested slopes. Earl Thirsk and his survivors should be just fine until someone sent the necessary ships to take them home again. Opal had plenty of fresh water, they'd already erected sufficient shelter, especially for the summer, and landed enough provisions to carry them for at least 6 months, even if they were unable to add anything by hunting and fishing. And Caleb had relented just a bit and left a small store of captured matchlocks and arbalests on the beach when his ships weighed anchor this morning. Of course, what's going to happen to Thirsk when he gets home may be something else entirely, Merlin thought grimly. He's the senior Dolaran admiral who's coming home after the worst naval disaster in Dolar's history, and what I've seen of King Ronald suggests he's going to be looking for scapegoats more than explanations. He thought about it for a moment longer, then put the matter of Earl Thirsk's future away and leaned out across the hammock nettings to look back at the line of sails following along astern of Dreadnought. The last thick, dark pillars of smoke from over 50 blazing ships still trailed across the sky, following the galleon fleet out of its anchorage. The line of ships looked impressive and proud after 2 5-days of repairs, with the brooms lashed to the heads of their main topgallant masts. Caleb had laughed out loud when Merlin suggested that gesture and explained the symbolism behind it,
but then he'd sobered as he realized how apt it was. His galleon certainly had swept the sea clean of their enemies. Merlin's lips twitched in a remembered smile of his own, but then it faded, for three sails were missing, and he felt a fresh stab of grief for the schooner Wyvern. He didn't know what had happened to her. She'd been there, riding the fury of the gale, in one snark pass. In the next, she'd simply been gone. He'd been able to locate no survivors of her 90-man crew, not even any wreckage. Then there was Dragon, lost so spectacularly in the final stage of the Crag Reach action. And HMS Lightning, one of the converted merchantmen from Sir Dominic Stainair's column, had taken more damage in the action off Rock Point than Merlin had first thought. She'd made it to the rendezvous in the lee of Samuel Island with the rest of Stainair's ships, but then she'd slowly foundered over the course of that long, stormy night. The good news was that they'd at least gotten almost all of her people safely off before she finally went down. Typhoon's repairs had taken the full 2 5-days Caleb had predicted, but she had a brand new mainmast, and the rest of the fleet had made good use of the time it had taken to replace the original. They'd replenished their water from Opal Island, their provisions from captured stores, and their magazines and shot lockers from Traveler and Summer Moon, and all of the other galleons had been able to repair their own battle damages while Captain Stewart worked on his. The survivors from Dragon and Lightning had been distributed throughout the rest of the fleet, making up the worst of their personnel losses as well, so at least all of the surviving galleons were combat ready. "I wish we could have gotten out of here sooner," Caleb muttered. The prince was talking to himself, but Merlin's hearing was rather more acute than most, and he gave Caleb another look. "You were the one who said we needed to make good our damages," he pointed out. "You had a point, and Dominic agreed with you." "But you didn't," Caleb said, turning to face him fully while the steady, gentle breeze ruffled his hair. "I didn't disagree either," Merlin responded, and shrugged. "You were right when you pointed out that there wasn't a perfect decision. Somebody had to choose, and you happen to be the crown prince around here." "I know," Caleb sighed. For just a moment, he looked twice his age. Then he shook himself and produced a wry smile. "You know, usually being crown prince is a pretty good job, but there are times when it's really not so much fun." "So I've observed. But the important thing, I suppose, is that you need to remember you are the one who has to make the decisions, and you aren't usually going to have lots of time to sit around and ponder them. By and large, the people who are going to second-guess and criticize you after the fact are going to be doing it from some place nice and safe, with all the advantages of hindsight and plenty of time to think about what you did wrong." "That's more or less what Father said once or twice," Caleb said. "Well, he's right. And the good news, you know, is that when you do get it right, like the decision to go straight into Crag Reach, you also get all the credit for it." Merlin grinned. "Just think, now you're a certified military genius." "Yeah, sure," Caleb rolled his eyes. "And I can already hear Father cutting me back down to size when I get too full of myself over it, too."
2. Erastor Bay, Princedom of Emerald.
"What's so important you have to drag me out of bed in the middle of the night?" Duke Blackwater demanded irritably, tying the sash of a light robe as he glowered at Thomas Barman, Baron Whitecastle. The Baron rose from the chair in Coruscant's great cabin as the Duke stamped in from his sleeping cabin. Blackwater had been in bed for less than 3 hours after yet another contentious conference, or perhaps acrimonious debate might have been a better term, with his unwilling allies. He was not in a particularly good mood.
"I apologize for disturbing you, Your Grace," Whitecastle said, bowing respectfully. "I think, however, that you'll agree this is something you need to know about now."
"For your sake, I hope you're right," Blackwater growled, and waved the Baron brusquely back into his chair.
The Duke snapped his fingers, and his servant appeared as if by magic, carrying the brandy decanter and glasses on a silver tray. He poured two glasses, handed one to each nobleman, and then disappeared just as expeditiously.
"All right," Blackwater said, a bit less snappishly, as he lowered his half-empty glass a moment later. "Tell me what's so important."
"Of course, Your Grace."
Whitecastle leaned forward in his chair, clasping his own unsampled glass in both hands.
"As you know, of course, I've been stationed here as the Prince's ambassador to Emerald for over 4 years now. During that time, by and large, he's been very careful to keep me separate from Earl Corus's operations here in the Princedom."
He paused, and Blackwater grimaced, waving impatiently for him to continue. Yet Whitecastle noticed that a spark of interest had begun to glow in the Duke's eyes.
"That's just changed," he said in response to the Duke's gesture. "I was contacted this evening, less than 2 hours ago, in fact, by a man I'd never met before, but who had all of the correct code words to—"
"Correct code words?" Blackwater interrupted.
"Yes, Your Grace."
If Whitecastle was irritated by the interruption, he was careful not to show it.
"When I was first sent to Emerald, my instructions included a sealed envelope to be opened only under certain specific conditions. That envelope contained a series of code words to be used by especially trusted agents of Earl Corus."
Blackwater was listening very intently now, leaning slightly forward while he rested one elbow on the table beside him.
"This man, who correctly identified himself, was placed in Telesburg over 12 years ago, Your Grace. He was placed in complete isolation, totally separate from any other agents in Corus. None of Earl Corus's other agents knew him. He knew none of them. His job, his sole job, was to be a good, loyal Carisian, hopefully employed in or near the royal dockyards, until and unless war broke out between the League of Coruscant and Carus. Apparently, Earl Corus assumed that in the event of a war, he'd lose access to at least a portion of any spy web he'd established, and this man was part of his insurance policy."
He paused again, and Blackwater nodded.
"Continue, Baron," he said. "I assure you you have my attention."
"I rather thought I might, Your Grace."
Whitecastle finally allowed himself a small smile. Then his expression sobered once more.
"Apparently Wave Thunder and his people knew a great deal more than any of us had imagined about Earl Corus's official spies in Carus. And, it would appear, Wave Thunder and Harald also knew what was coming quite a bit earlier than we thought they did."
"Why?"
"Because, Your Grace, they very, very quietly arrested virtually all foreign spies in Telesburg, and apparently everywhere else in the entire kingdom, clear back in early October."
"October?"
"Yes, Your Grace. Obviously they must have realized at least part of what was coming much earlier than we'd been assuming they did. And I think that probably accounts for the silence from Earl Corus's other agents which you've mentioned. But they missed this man because not even Corus's other agents knew about him," Blackwater said slowly.
"That's certainly what appears to have happened, Your Grace."
"But—"
Blackwater's eyes sharpened.
"I'm willing to guess he didn't come to you just to tell you all the rest of our spies had been arrested 3 months ago. So, Baron, what brought him to your door at this particular time?"
"Actually, Your Grace, he's been trying to get to me for over 2 months now, but it hasn't been easy. The Carizians have put an iron clamp on traffic through the Throat and around Lock Island, and they've got light units patrolling the Carriz Sea north of Rockshoal Bay. He had to travel overland to avoid the Throat, then find a smuggler willing to run him across to Emerald. In fact, it took him 3 tries to get across, because the smuggler in question turned back twice after sighting a Carizian schooner. But you're quite correct that he didn't come on a whim. In fact, he came to tell us the entire Carizian galleon force left Carriz under Crown Prince Caleb's personal command in October.
What?
Blackwater blinked in surprise, then half-glared at the ambassador.
That's ridiculous! Our scouts have seen their topsails behind Harald's galleys!
Not according to this man, Your Grace, Whitecastle said diffidently. He's been a ship's chandler supplying ships in the Royal Dockyard in Tellisburg for over 5 years, and according to what he's picked up from friends he's cultivated in their navy, 30 of the galleons the Carizians have been working so hard to arm sailed from Lock Island 5 days before you reached Erester Bay. And, the Baron said, also according to what he's learned, the Carizians still haven't activated their reserve galleys. Not only that, but King Harald's chartered 2 or 3 dozen merchant galleons for unspecified purposes. While he wasn't able to absolutely confirm that, he did observe himself that at least 12 merchant ships which had been idled by the war have left Tellisburg flying the royal banner. No one seems to know exactly where they are. Blackwater's jaw clenched. Was it truly possible?
You say he says they sailed in October. He doesn't have any idea where?
None, Whitecastle admitted.
Well, they wouldn't have sailed without some destination in mind, Blackwater said slowly, thinking aloud. I wonder.
He glowered at the floor, rubbing his chin, then shook his head and looked back up at Whitecastle.
We've all been assuming Harald didn't know what was coming until shortly before we sailed. But if he got those galleons to sea that early, he must have known something, and he probably knew it almost as soon as we did. But he couldn't have found out about it from spies in Khorasan. There wasn't time for anyone to get a message to him all the way from Manchir that quickly. And he couldn't have found out about it that early from spies in Emerald, because Narmon didn't know that soon, thanks to those lost dispatches. Which means he could only have found out from Taro.
The ambassador frowned for a moment, obviously considering Blackwater's analysis, then nodded.
I think you're right, Your Grace, but how much did anyone in Taro know?
I can't answer that, Blackwater admitted.
Obviously, Gorja had to know at least the bare bones of what we were going to be doing, because he had to coordinate what he was supposed to do with it. But I don't have any idea how fully informed he may have been about our plans. And,
his mouth tightened,
it doesn't really matter. Not if the galleon sailed that long ago, and Harald's been using the sails of chartered merchant ships to fool our scouts, and me, into thinking they're still with him.
Your Grace?
Whitecastle looked confused, and Blackwater laughed harshly.
He sent his galleons off somewhere his galleys didn't have the sea-keeping ability to go, my lord, he said. And if he learned what was happening from agents in Taro, I can only think of one thing that would have taken them away so soon and prevented them from returning by now.
The Duke shook his head, his expression bemused, almost awed.
He's decided to risk an all-or-nothing throw of the dice, he said. He sent his galleons and his son off to intercept the Tarosians and the Dolorans. He doesn't have them here, not protecting Rockshoal Bay.
They're off somewhere with Caleb in the Sea of Justice, or the Parker Sea, depending on how good his spy's information really was, hoping to find Duke Malachi and stop him from ever getting here.
That's cr—
Whitecastle began, then stopped. He cleared his throat.
I mean, that strikes me as a very risky thing for him to have done, Your Grace.
It's an insane thing for him to have done, Blackwater said flatly. At the same time, it's the only possible answer for where his galleons have really been all this time. And—
His voice trailed off again, and his expression darkened.
Your Grace,
Whitecastle said quietly after several moments.
It's just occurred to me that there could be one way for him to pull it all together with a fair degree of confidence.
Blackwater's lips twitched in something that was much more snarl than smile.
If his spies in Taro were good enough, or if someone highly enough placed were deliberately feeding him information, he could have learned from the Tarosians where they were supposed to find the Dolorans.
Your Grace, are you suggesting Gorja himself might have delivered the information to Karis?
Whitecastle asked in a very careful tone.
I don't know, Blackwater shrugged. At first glance, I can't see any reason for him to have done it. Certainly not to have risked angering Vicar Zamsin or the Grand Inquisitor. But that doesn't mean someone else highly placed in his court couldn't have done it.
The Duke glowered at the deck again for several more seconds, then gave his entire body a shake.
We may never know the answer to your question, my lord, but if your man's report is accurate, what matters is that at this moment there are only 80 galleys or so between us and control of Rockshoal Bay. And if we can defeat those galleys and take control of Rockshoal Bay, we can both hold it against his galleons, if and when they finally return, and bring in troops to besiege the quays from the land side.
Those numbers assume their reserve fleet truly hasn't been activated, Your Grace,
Whitecastle pointed out, and the Duke snorted.
If I'm prepared to believe this spy of yours really knows his business and risk trusting what he said about the galleons, I may as well believe him about the galleys as well.
Blackwater shrugged.
And, to be honest, we've seen no sign of the Carisian reserve galleys. I've been assuming all along that the manning requirements of their galleons prevented them from manning the galleys as well. So I'm strongly inclined to believe he is right about that.
And what do you intend to do about it, if I may ask, Your Grace?
Whitecastle asked. The Duke quirked an eyebrow at him, and it was the Baron's turn to shrug.
I am Prince Hector's ambassador, Your Grace. If whatever you decide to do requires Prince Narmon's support, then I may be in a position to help nudge him into doing what you want.
True enough, Blackwater conceded.
As for what I intend, though, that's going to depend on what I can talk my gallant allies into.
3. HMS Dreadnought, The Cauldron.
Crown Prince Caleb sat up in the box-like cot suspended from the low beams of his sleeping cabin's deckhead as someone rapped sharply on the cabin door.
What?
He said, rubbing his eyes before he glanced out the open stern windows into the warm, clear night. The moon hadn't even risen yet, which meant he'd been in bed only an hour or so.
I'm sorry to wake you, Caleb, a deep voice said, but we need to talk.
Merlin?
Caleb swung his legs over the side of the cot and stood. There was a note in Merlin's voice he'd never heard before, and he crossed the cabin in two strides and yanked the door open.
What is it? What's happened?
May I come in?
What?
Caleb gave himself a shake, then grinned crookedly as he realized he'd opened the door without bothering to dress. In fact, he was stark naked, the way he habitually slept on such warm nights,
and he stepped back with a chuckle, despite the tension in Merlin's voice.
"Of course you can come in," he said.
"Thank you." Merlin stepped past Sergeant Faircaster, the sentry outside Caleb's door, bending his head to clear the deck beams and close the door quietly behind him.
"What is it?"
Caleb asked, turning away to pick up the tunic he'd discarded when he turned in and drag it over his head.
"I've just had a vision," Merlin said, and Caleb turned back quickly at his tone, waving sharply at a chair.
"What sort of vision?"
"A vision of Duke Blackwater in Erastor Bay," Merlin said, his voice almost flat as he settled into the indicated chair. "It seems Benjamin and I missed at least one of Hector's spies, and he's just reported to Blackwater that..." "So, that's about the size of it," Merlin finished grimly several minutes later. Caleb sat on the edge of his cot, his face almost totally expressionless as he concentrated on what Merlin had just told him.
"What do you think he's going to do?" the prince asked now, and Merlin shook his head.
"I think he was right when he told Whitecastle that depends on what he can convince his allies to do, Caleb. All I can tell you right now is that Coruscant's finally managed to get practically its entire reserve sent forward. Emerald has about 60 of its galleys into full commission, too, and despite everything Charlian, Sanders, and Sharpfield have been able to do, they've been forced to send another 20 of their galleys forward to Erastor as well. Even with the losses Brian and your father inflicted on them, that brings them up to 180 to your father's 80. Well, 76, given the 4 he lost on the reef off Crown Point last 5 day.
"Better than 2-1, Caleb muttered.
"And," Merlin added, "given that Blackwater knows, or strongly suspects, that we're somewhere else, he's almost certainly going to be tempted to try to strike before we can get back, if he can talk his allies into it."
15 days if the wind holds steady," Caleb grated. 3 5-days!"
He slammed his right fist into his left palm suddenly.
"Damn! I should have started home without making repairs!"
"Remember what I said about hindsight," Merlin told him. The youthful Crown Prince glared at him, and he gave a small shrug. "You made a decision. You didn't know this was going to happen. Right now you need to concentrate on what we do next, not on what we've already done."
"What I've already done, you mean," Caleb said bitterly.
Then he threw back his shoulders and inhaled deeply.
"But whoever did it, you're right. The problem is there doesn't seem to be a lot we can do."
Merlin tried to think of something to say, but there wasn't much he could. The surviving galleons were already making their best speed, driving hard as they close-reached across the cauldron on a steady wind out of the east-northeast at almost 10 knots. They might be able to squeeze a little more speed out of some of the ships, but the merchant conversions had the typical high-capacity hulls of their merchant ancestry. They tended to be shorter and tubbier than naval galleons, especially Oliver's designs, like Dreadnought. They were already carrying virtually all the canvas they had, just to stay with their special-built consorts. If the fleet tried to sail faster, it could only be at the expense of leaving its slower ships behind, and it probably would shave no more than a day or two off its total transit time anyway.
"If only Father knew about this," Caleb said softly to himself, pounding his fist gently but rhythmically into his palm once more. "If only..."
His hand suddenly stopped moving, and his head came back up, his eyes locking on Merlin in the dimly lit sleeping cabin.
"Can you tell him?" he asked softly,
and Merlin froze. He looked back at the young man sitting on the cot, and his thoughts seemed to grind to a complete halt.
"Caleb, I..." he began, then stopped. How much was Caleb truly prepared to accept about him?
The prince had already taken far more in stride than Merlin would ever willingly have shown him, but where were the limits of Caleb's flexibility? He might half-jestingly refer to Merlin as his wizard, and he might have accepted Merlin's more-than-human strength and vision. He might even have recognized the inevitable clash between his kingdom and the corrupt men sitting in power in the temple. But he was still a Safeholdian, still a child of the Church of God awaiting, which was the very reason he was so angry about the corruption which afflicted it. And he'd still been steeped from birth in the belief that Pei Shan Wei was the mother of all evil, and that the angels who'd fallen into evil with her had become demons, determined to tempt humanity into following Shan Wei's thirst for forbidden knowledge into damnation. "Do you really want me to answer that question?" he asked after a long, still moment. Caleb started to answer, but Merlin raised one hand. "Think first, Caleb. If you ask, and I answer it, you'll never be able to unask it." Caleb looked at him for perhaps 3 heartbeats, then nodded. "I want you to answer it," he said steadily. "All right, then," Merlin replied, just as steadily. "The answer is yes." Caleb's expression started to blossom in relief, and he opened his mouth once more, but Merlin shook his head. "I can tell him this very night, even though he's 4,000 miles away," he continued, "but only by physically going to him." Caleb's mouth snapped shut. Silence hovered once more in the sleeping cabin. A taut, singing silence, enhanced but not broken by the background sound of water sluicing around the hull, the bubble of the wake below the open stern windows, the creak of rigging and hull timbers, and the occasional sound of the rudder. "You can go to him?" Caleb said finally. "Yes," Merlin sighed. "Merlin," Caleb said, gazing at him levelly, "are you a demon after all?" "No." Merlin returned his gaze just as levelly. "I'm not a demon, Caleb, nor am I an angel. I told you that before in King's Harbor. I'm..." He shook his head. "When I told you then that I couldn't explain it to you, I meant I literally can't. If I tried, it would involve concepts and knowledge you simply don't have." Caleb looked at him for 15 endless, tense seconds, his eyes narrow, and when he spoke again, his voice was very soft. "Would that knowledge violate the prescriptions?" he asked. "Yes," Merlin said simply. And if he'd still been a creature of flesh and blood, he would have held his breath. Caleb Armok sat very, very still, gazing at the being who had become his friend. He sat that way for a long time, and then he shook himself. "How can you say you stand for the light when your very existence violates the prescriptions?" "Caleb," Merlin said, "I've told you before that I've never lied to you, even when I haven't been able to tell you all the truth. I won't lie to you now either, and if there are still things I simply can't explain, I can tell you this. The prescriptions themselves are a lie." Caleb inhaled sharply, and his head flinched back as if Merlin had just punched him. "The prescriptions were handed down by God himself," he said, his voice sharper, and Merlin shook his head. "No, they weren't, Caleb," he said. "They were handed down by Zhuo Zheng, and Sen Zhuo Zheng was no more an archangel than I am." Caleb flinched again, and his face was pale. Merlin's eyes, his artificial eyes, could see it clearly, despite the dim light. "How can the prescriptions be a lie?" the prince demanded hoarsely. "Are you saying God lied?" "No,"
Merlin said again.
God didn't lie. Zhuo Zhang lied when she claimed to speak for him.
But... Caleb broke off, staring at Merlin, and Merlin held out his right hand, cupped palm uppermost.
Caleb, you know the men who currently rule the temple are corrupt. They lie. They accept bribes. They use the prescriptions to extort money out of people who try to introduce new ideas, or from people who want new ideas suppressed. You yourself told me, standing on top of the citadel with Regis, that the vicars are more concerned with their secular power than with saving souls. They're willing to destroy your entire kingdom, burn your cities, murder and terrorize your subjects, when you've done nothing at all wrong. Is it so inconceivable to you that other men have also used God and twisted his purpose for ends of their own?
We aren't talking about men, Caleb said. We're talking about the archangels themselves.
Yes, we are, Merlin acknowledged. But the beings who called themselves archangels weren't, Caleb. They were men.
No,
Caleb said, yet his voice's certitude wavered, and Merlin felt a small flicker of hope.
If you want me to, I can show you proof of that, he said gently. Not tonight, not here, but I can show it to you. You've seen the things, some of the things, I can do. The men and women who claim to be archangels could do the same sorts of things, and they used that ability to pretend they were divine beings. I can prove that to you if you're willing to let me. The problem, Caleb, is that if your faith in the lie you've been taught all your life is too strong, you won't believe any proof I could show you.
Caleb sat motionless, his jaw clenched tightly and his shoulders hunched as if to ward off a blow. And then, slowly, so slowly, his shoulders relaxed just a bit.
If you truly are a demon, despite whatever you say, he said at last, then you've already tempted me into damnation, haven't you?
He actually managed a twisted smile.
I've known for months now that you were more than mortal, and I've used you and your abilities for my own ends and against the princes of the church. And that's the definition of heresy and apostasy, isn't it?
I suppose it is, Merlin said, his voice as neutral as he could make it. In the eyes of the temple's present management, at least.
But you didn't have to tell me you could warn Father, any more than you had to save those children in King's Harbor, or to save Regis from Calvin, or to lead me to Malachi's galleys, or into Crag Reach.
I suppose not. But, Caleb, if I were a demon out to tempt you into damnation, I'd do it by appealing to your desire, your need, to protect the people and kingdom you love. You aren't Hector, or even Narmon. I couldn't appeal to your greed, your hunger for power, so I'd tempt you through the goodness of your own heart, your fear for the things you care so deeply about.
And probably tell me you would have done exactly that, on the assumption that I'd believe it proved you hadn't, Caleb said, nodding with that same crooked smile.
But you missed my point. Perhaps you are a demon, or what the writ calls a demon at any rate. And perhaps you have tempted me. After all, you always told Father and me you were using us for your own ends.
But if you've tempted me into the damnation of my soul, Merlin Athrawes, then so be it, because you've never asked me to do one single thing which wasn't what a just and loving God would have had me do. And if the God of the writ isn't a just and loving God, then he isn't mine either.
Merlin sat back in his chair, gazing at the young man in front of him. The young man, he realized, who was even more extraordinary than Merlin had believed.
Caleb, he said finally, in your place, I doubt I could reach beyond everything I'd been taught
the way you just have." "I don't know if I really have," the prince replied with a shrug. "You say you can prove what you've said, and some day I'll hold you to that. But for now, I have to make decisions, choices. I can only make them on the basis of what I believe, and I believe you're a good man, whatever else you may be. And I believe you can warn my father."
"And how do you think your father will react if I suddenly simply appear aboard his flagship 4,000 miles from here?" Merlin asked wryly.
"I don't know," Caleb said, then grinned suddenly. "But I'd dearly love to see his expression when you do."
4. The Cauldron.
Merlin Athrawes lay stretched out, swooping up and down with the swell as he floated on his back, watching the moon. Somewhere beyond his toes, invisible from his present water-level position, HMS Dreadnought and her consorts continued on their course, unaware one of their crewmen was missing. Hopefully, they'd stay that way. "This," he thought philosophically, gazing up at the stars, "is probably the least wise thing I've done yet, aside from the Krakens, maybe, anyway. No matter how well Caleb took it, there's no way of telling how Harald is going to react. Still, right off the top of his head, he couldn't come up with any alternative course of action which offered a better chance for Harald's survival. In cold-blooded terms, now that he'd had a chance to think about things a bit more, it probably didn't matter to the long-term survival of Karis what happened to King Harald and his galleys. What Caleb and Sir Dominic Stainer had already done to one galley fleet promised they could do the same to another, if they had to. Especially one which was going to take losses of its own, serious losses, if it pressed an attack home against the Royal Carizian Navy. So even if Blackwater succeeded in gaining control of the Karis Sea and Rockshoal Bay, it would be only a temporary possession, lasting just long enough for Caleb to get home and take them back again. And however badly Harald's death might hurt the rulership of Karis, Merlin felt confident of Caleb's fitness to take the crown, especially with Grey Harbor and Wave Thunder to advise him. But while Karis might survive King Harald's death, Merlin had discovered he wasn't prepared to do that himself, or to see Caleb forced to do it, not without doing everything he possibly could to prevent it. It was odd, he reflected as he rose high enough on the swell to glimpse the lights of one of the galleons in the distance, but when he'd first set out to shape Karis into the tool he needed, it hadn't occurred to him how close he might come to the Carizians themselves as people, as individuals he cared about. Harald Armach wasn't simply the king of Karis. He was also Merlin Athrawes's friend, and the father of another, even closer friend, and the man who had once been Nimu Alban had lost too many friends. "Is that the real reason I let Caleb talk me into telling him I could do this in the first place? Or," he frowned as another thought occurred to him, "was it because I'm so lonely? Because I need someone to know what I'm trying to do? How far from home I truly am. These people may be my friends, but none of them know who or what I really am. Do I have some sort of subconscious need to know that someone who considers me a friend knows the truth, or as much of the truth as he can comprehend anyway, about me?" Perhaps he did, and perhaps that need was a dangerous chink in his armor. No matter how Caleb or even Harald might react, the vast majority of Safeholdians, even in Karis, would indeed regard him as the very spawn of hell if they discovered even a tenth of the truth about him. And if that happened, everything which had ever been associated with him would be tainted, rejected with horror. So, in the final analysis, if he allowed a need for friendship to lure him into revealing the truth to someone not prepared to accept it, or simply to someone who might inadvertently let the secret slip, everything he'd accomplished so far, and all the people who died along the way and who were still going to die, would have been for nothing. All of that was true, He knew that, but he wasn't prepared to psychoanalyze himself in an effort to parse his motivation, even assuming a Pika was subject to psychoanalysis. Because, in the end, it didn't matter. Whatever the reasons for it, this was something he had to do, something he couldn't not do. He rose to the top of another swell. This time there were no lights in sight, and he gave a mental nod of satisfaction as he checked the overhead visual imagery being relayed from the stealthed recon skimmer hovering above him. The fleet was moving along nicely, drawing steadily further away from him as he floated alone in the immensity of the sea. Getting someone off a crowded, cramped sailing vessel without being noticed, he'd discovered, was only marginally less difficult than he expected getting someone onto a crowded, cramped galley without being noticed to be. The fact that the full moon had risen now only made the task even more challenging. Fortunately, he and Caleb had already put a defense in depth into place, even if they'd never contemplated using it for exactly this purpose. Arnold Falcon and the other members of Caleb's Marine Bodyguard Detachment all knew the truth about Sejin Merlin. Every one of them knew Merlin had visions, and that it was necessary for him to retire and meditate in order to see them. And every one of them knew that concealing the fact of his visions from anyone outside King Harald's or Caleb's innermost circle was absolutely essential. And so, Merlin, as an officer of the Royal Guard and Caleb's personal guardsman, had been provided with his own small private cabin. It was right aft, just below Caleb's quarters. It even had its own stern window, and Falcon and the other marine sentries who guarded Caleb were well placed to intercept anyone who might have disturbed the Sejin during his meditations. They were also well accustomed to leaving Merlin to those same meditations themselves, all of which meant it had been relatively simple for him to crawl through that window and lower himself hand over hand down a rope into the water. Once in the water, he'd submerged and swum the better part of a half mile, then surfaced and waited while the fleet sailed past him. He was down moon from them, and he'd probably been far enough away when he surfaced that no one would have noticed anything, but he felt no great urge to take any chances. The night was clear as only a tropical night could be, with glowing phosphorescence spilling back along the ship's sides as they sailed along the silver moon path, their canvas like polished pewter, their ports and scuttles glowing with the lamps and lanterns within. The odds against anyone happening to glance in exactly the right direction to see something as small as a human figure floating into the heavens was undoubtedly minute, but he had plenty of time, certainly enough to avoid taking any chances. Or, he corrected himself wryly, any more chances at least. He checked the visual imagery one last time, then activated his built-in communicator. "Ow," he said, speaking aloud for a change, still contemplating Safehold's alien heavens.
"Yes, Lieutenant Commander."
"Pick me up now."
"Yes, Lieutenant Commander."
5. HMS Royal Caris, Caris C. King Harald the Seventh waved his valet out the door.
"Are you sure you won't be needing me any more tonight, sire?"
"Lachlan, you've already asked me that 3 times,
Harald said affectionately.
"I'm not yet so feeble that I can't climb into bed by myself, even at sea. So go, go! Get some sleep of your own." "Very well, sire, if you insist,"
Lachlan Jessup said with a small smile, and obeyed the command. Harald shook his head with a chuckle, then crossed the great cabin, opened the latticed-paned door, and stepped out onto Royal Caris's sternwalk. He stood there, gazing off into the west, as if watching the setting moon slide the rest of the way below the horizon could somehow bring him closer to his son. It was even harder being separated from Caleb than he'd expected it to be. It wasn't like the year Caleb had spent aboard ship as a midshipman. Then all he'd really had to worry about were the risks of disease, accidents, or shipwreck.
Now he'd knowingly sent his elder son off to battle against an enormously numerically superior foe 7,000 miles away. If all had gone well, the battle Caleb had been sent to fight was long over. But had his son won, or had he lost? And, in either case, had he survived? Not for the first time in the long, hard years of his kingship, Harald Armach found that knowing he'd made the right decision could be very cold comfort indeed.
Your Majesty?
Harald twitched uncontrollably, then whirled, one hand dropping to the hilt of the dagger he wasn't wearing. He half-crouched, despite his bad knee, his incredulous eyes wide as he saw the tall, broad-shouldered man standing in the shadows at the far end of the sternwalk. Disbelief and shock held him motionless, paralyzed as a statue, staring at the man who could not possibly be there.
"I apologize for startling you, Your Majesty," Merlin Athrawes said calmly and quietly, "but Caleb sent me with a message."
The Armach dynasty, Merlin decided, must have some sort of genetic defect. That was the only explanation he could think of, because something was obviously badly wrong with its fight-or-flight instincts. King Harald should have reacted by at least shouting for the guards, assuming he hadn't simply bolted for the cabin, or even flung himself over the sternwalk to escape the apparition. In fact, Merlin had brought along a stun pistol for the express purpose of dealing with any such perfectly reasonable reaction, although he hadn't looked forward to explaining its effect to an irate monarch afterward. But instead of doing any of those things, Harald had simply stood there for almost exactly 10 seconds by Merlin's internal chronometer, then straightened and cocked his head to one side.
"Well, Sajin Merlin," he'd said with appalling calm, "if Caleb sent you with a message, at least I know he's still alive, don't I?"
And he'd smiled. Now, 20 minutes later, the two of them stood together, still on the sternwalk, the one place on the flagship where they could hope to find true privacy. The noise of wind and sea as Royal Caris and her squadron moved slowly along with the rest of the fleet neatly covered their voices as well.
"So Caleb sent you to tell me Blackwater seen through our little masquerade, did he, Master Trainer?"
Harald asked, and Merlin chuckled, shaking his head, as he remembered the first time Harald had called him that.
"Yes, Your Majesty." Merlin inclined his head slightly, then snorted gently. "And if you'll permit me to say it, Your Majesty, you've taken my arrival rather more calmly than I anticipated."
"Over the last year, Merlin, I've come to expect the unexpected from you. And don't think I missed how carefully you answered Father Pater's questions when he brought his truth stone with him, or the way Caleb watched you while you did it, or any of several other peculiar things you've accomplished over the months. All the interesting bits and pieces of knowledge you've produced. The fact that, despite your rather glib explanation at the time, there's not really any way you could have gotten to Calvin's townhouse as quickly as you did."
The king waved one hand in an oddly gentle gesture of dismissal.
"I decided long ago," he said calmly, "that you were far more than you chose to appear, even to me, or possibly even to Caleb. And yes," he smiled, "I know how close you've become to my son. But, as I believed I mentioned to you once before, a man, any man, regardless of his abilities, must be judged by his actions. I've judged you on the basis of yours, and, like my son, I trust you. If I'm in error to do so, no doubt I'll pay for it in the next world. Unfortunately, I have to make my decisions in this one, don't I?"
"Your son is very like you, Your Majesty." Merlin inclined his head once more, this time in a bow of respect. "And I can think of few greater compliments I might pay him."
In that case, now that we've both told one another what splendid people we are,
Harald said with a smile,
I suppose we should decide what to do with this latest information of yours.
It's not certain yet what use Blackwater will be able to make of his spy's report, Merlin replied. From what I've seen of him, however, I expect him to bring the other admirals around to his own view. He has a more forceful personality than I'd first expected, and the fact that all his allies know he's being backed by the Group of Four gives him a powerful club whenever he chooses to use it.
In that case, he certainly will try to press the attack, and as quickly as possible.
Harald gazed up at the stars where the moon had finished setting while he and Merlin spoke. He frowned, stroking his beard.
He can't know how much time he has before Caleb's return, the king continued,
obviously thinking aloud.
So he'll probably try to press an attack directly into Rockshoal Bay. He'll expect us to either stand and fight, or else retreat behind Lock Island and the Keys. In either case, he'll have control of the bay and the Corus Sea, at least until Caleb gets home.
That's essentially what Caleb and I decided his most likely course of action would be, Merlin agreed.
And Caleb's suggestion was?
Harald looked back at Merlin. He suggests that you go ahead and concede the bay, Merlin shrugged. As long as you still control the throat, even if you were to lose one or both of the keys, they aren't going to be able to press a serious attack on any of your vital areas. And Caleb's only 15 days away. If they're deep enough into the bay when he arrives, they'll be trapped between your forces and his.
I see my son is concerned about his aged father's survival,
Harald said dryly. Excuse me, Your Majesty?
I've already discovered that Blackwater, while he may be lumbered with allies who aren't exactly the most cooperative ones imaginable, is no fool, Merlin. He knows Caleb's going to be coming home. If he sends his fleet into Rockshoal Bay, he's not going to send it so deep he can't get it out again in a hurry. Nor is he going to neglect the elementary precaution of picketing the approaches. Whether Caleb comes south from Emerald Reach or north from Darkos Sound, he'll be spotted long before he can trap Blackwater in the bay. So what Caleb's strategy would really accomplish would be to keep me safely behind Lock Island while almost certainly affording Blackwater the time to fall back on Erastor Bay, or even retreat past Emerald to Zebediah or Coruscant to avoid him when he arrives. And, of course, my own forces would take so long to clear the bottleneck between Lock Island and the Keys that we'd never be able to stop Blackwater before he ran.
If we approached under the cover of night, Merlin began, then...
Then, if everything went perfectly, you might be able to pull it off,
Harald interrupted.
But, as Regis pointed out, what can go wrong in a battle plan will. No. If we want to finish Hector's navy, hiding behind Lock Island is the wrong way to go about it.
It sounds to me as if you plan to do something else, Your Majesty, Merlin observed with a slight sense of dread.
I do indeed,
Harald showed his teeth.
I have no intention of allowing myself to be penned up in the throat, nor do I intend to give Blackwater the battle he wants. However, I do intend to dangle the possibility of that battle in front of him.
How, Your Majesty?
I'm about to shift my main base of operations south from Rockshoal Bay to Darkos Sound. Darkos Keep isn't as well suited as a major fleet base as Lock Island, but it will serve well enough for long enough. When Blackwater manages to launch his offensive, I'll dance and spar for time, and I'll withdraw south, away from the bay. He's smart enough to recognize that my navy is his true objective. Once the fleet's out of his way, he can do basically whatever he wants. As long as the fleet exists, his options are cramped at best. So, unless I miss my guess,
He'll be so happy to have shifted me away from a well-fortified bolt-hole like Lock Island and the Throat that he'll follow me up.
You're planning to draw him south of the Karis Sea, Merlin said, away from his shortest line of retreat.
Precisely, Harald nodded. I'm sure he'll cover his rear with picket ships, and he'll only have so much reach. If I can pull him far enough south, keep his attention firmly enough focused on me, and the fact that my standard will be flying from this ship should certainly help to do that, then when Caleb comes down from the north behind him, you'll be between him and retreat.
Caleb won't like it, Your Majesty.
That's unfortunate, Harald said calmly. As it happens, I'm king, and he's crown prince, which means we'll do it my way.
But if you move your fleet south, Merlin said, searching for counterarguments, you'll expose the throat. The North Channel's broad enough they could slip galleys right through it if you're not there to stop them.
Not anymore, Harald chuckled. I see you haven't managed to keep an eye on quite everything, Sejin Merlin.
Your Majesty?
Baron Seamount and Sir Dustin have been busy in your absence. It was Seamount's idea. The two of them have thrown together what Seamount calls floating batteries. They're basically just rafts, big ones, but just rafts, with solid raised bulwarks about 5 feet thick and gun ports. They've got 15 of them, each with 30 carronades and a half battalion of marines to discourage boarders, anchored on springs squarely across North Channel, directly between Lock Island and North Key's shore batteries.
The king shrugged.
I don't believe anyone's likely to get past them, do you?
No, but...
Then we'll do it my way, won't we?
Harald asked inflexibly. Merlin looked at him for a long moment, then nodded heavily. Yes, Your Majesty.
The one thing I wish we could do, Harald said thoughtfully, is find some way for Caleb and me to coordinate our movements. If what I've got in mind works, Blackwater's going to be directly between Caleb's galleons and my galleys when you turn up in his rear. That means he'll see you, know you're there, before I do. If there were some way, aside, of course, from this rather dramatic personal visit of yours, for you to let me know when Caleb is about to make contact with him, it would be an enormous help.
He cocked his head again, looking at Merlin with an expression so much like that of a hopeful little boy that Merlin chuckled. As a matter of fact, Your Majesty, I've given a little thought of my own to that possibility. Here. He held out a small object. Harald gazed at it for an instant, then took it just a bit hesitantly, and Merlin was hard-pressed not to chuckle again. Apparently, even an Armok's imperturbability had its limits. That's a pager, Your Majesty.
A pager?
Harald repeated the bizarre word carefully. Yes, Your Majesty. Merlin had considered providing the king with a full-capability communicator, but he decided against it. Given how well Harald had handled his appearance on Royal Karras's sternwalk, his concern that the king might have found voices coming out of a tiny box more than he was prepared to accept had probably been misplaced. Unfortunately, he'd selected the pager instead before he left the skimmer.
It's set to vibrate when I need it to, he said now. May I demonstrate?
Of course, Harald said.
Then put it on your palm, please, Your Majesty. No, with the flat side down. That's right. Now... Merlin used his internal comm to trigger the pager, and the king's hand jerked as the vibration tingled sharply against the palm of his hand. He looked up at Merlin, and his eyes were wide, with as much delight as surprise, Merlin realized. You felt that, Your Majesty?
I certainly did.
Well, what I'd like you to do is carry that under your clothing somewhere, Merlin said. I was thinking you might use the wristband. It's adjustable, Your Majesty, like this, he demonstrated. to wear it on your forearm, under your tunic. If you do, then I can signal you when we sight Blackwater's ships. I was thinking I might cause it to vibrate one time when we first sight one of his scout ships, then twice when we sight his main body, and three times when we're prepared to engage.
That sounds as if it should work quite well, Harald said, gazing down at the pager now strapped to the inside of his left forearm.
Next time, Merlin said dryly, I'll try to provide something a bit more exotic, Your Majesty.
Harald looked up sharply, then laughed.
Point taken, Sejin Merlin. Point taken.
He gave the pager one last look, then smoothed the sleeve of his tunic over it.
I suppose it's time you were getting back to Caleb now, Merlin.
He reached out, resting his hands on Merlin's shoulders.
Tell him I'm proud of him. Very proud. And that I love him.
I will, Your Majesty. Not that he needs to be told.
Maybe not, but sometimes it's as important to say it as to hear it. And,
Harald gazed directly into Merlin's sapphire eyes,
for yourself, accept my thanks. The thanks of a king for helping him to protect his people, and of a father who knows you'll do all you can to keep his son safe.
Of course I will, Your Majesty.
Merlin bowed again, more deeply than ever, then straightened.
And now, as you say, it's time I was getting back to Caleb.
He boosted himself up to the sternwalk's rail, gazing down at the water below.
Do you really have to leave that way?
Harald asked.
Excuse me, Your Majesty?
Merlin looked back over his shoulder in surprise, for the king's tone had been almost wistful.
I was just thinking it would be marvelous to see someone fly,
Harald said in an undeniably wheedling tone.
I wish I could do that for you, Your Majesty, Merlin said, and almost to his surprise, he meant every word of it.
Unfortunately, I'm afraid your officers and seamen aren't quite ready for a flying Seijin. Maybe another time. But if one of them happened to look in exactly the wrong direction at exactly the wrong moment tonight... He shrugged, and Harald nodded.
I know, and you're right, the king said. But one of these days, when there's no one else about, I'm going to hold you to that maybe of yours.
Somehow, I'm sure you will, Your Majesty, Merlin said with a laugh, and dropped into the night with a quiet splash. 6. Galley Coruscant, Eraser Bay. Duke Blackwater sat in his chair at the head of the table in Coruscant's great cabin, his face impassive as he listened to Sir Kevin Mergan's voice. After careful consideration, he decided to allow his flag captain to present the new information to his allies instead of doing it himself. He couldn't change the fact that it was coming from one of Prince Hector's spies, but he could at least try to minimize the sense that he was personally ramming it down their throats. Not that he expected to fool anyone about that. He considered the faces of his two fellow admirals. Sharpfield looked skeptical, but then Sharpfield always looked skeptical. None of Blackwater's spies had been able to intercept any of Queen Charlian's dispatches to her fleet commander, despite their best efforts, but the Duke was privately certain of what he would have found if he had been able to read any of them. And, to be honest, he didn't blame Charlian a bit. In her shoes, he would have done everything he thought he could get away with to minimize his own exposure and losses in the service of one of his most bitter enemies. Not that understanding her motives made their consequences any more pleasant. Still, Sharpfield was also a considerably more experienced naval commander than Prince Narmon's Earl Mondeer, and however unwillingly his queen had been compelled to support this entire campaign, Sharpfield was far too intelligent to do anything overt to which the group of four might take exception. Mondeer was another matter,
Unlike Charlian, Narman had every reason to want this campaign to succeed. Well, to see it avoid failure, which wasn't precisely the same thing, perhaps. Blackwater, now that he'd met the Prince of Emerald, had come to the conclusion that his own ruler had underestimated him. Narman was anything but the fool Blackwater had been warned to expect, and, the Duke was quietly certain, he'd made arrangements of his own to protect himself from the consequences of a victory by Prince Hector. Whether or not those arrangements would work was another matter, of course, but either way, he was even more certain Narman would prefer to take his chances against a victorious Hector rather than against a victorious and enraged Harald. That would definitely appear to be the case, judging by the way Narman's navy had responded to Blackwater's orders in the 2 months since the destruction of Baron Tanler Keep's squadron, at any rate. Mondeer had pitched in and goaded his own captains and crews into energetic, if not necessarily wildly enthusiastic, cooperation with Blackwater's rigorous training exercises. Sharpfield's cooperation had been less enthusiastic than Mondeer's, but by the same token, his captains had been better trained to begin with. And Blackwater had taken Sharpfield's own experience into consideration and sought his advice in planning the fleet's exercises, which actually appeared to have gotten the senior Chisholm officer actively involved in the process. The Duke had also been careful to stay fairly close to home during those 2 months, unwilling to offer the Carizians the opportunity to lure another detachment into a trap until he'd whipped his command into something a bit more cohesive, and his efforts had borne fruit. There were still weak spots, of course. Blackwater suspected there would have been in any coalition this diverse, even if all of its members had wanted to join it in the first place. The worst weakness of all was that the components of the fleet were still organized on a national basis. Blackwater would really have preferred to break up all three of the Allied fleets and recombine their units into integrated squadrons. Not even Mondeer was going to agree to that one, though. Short of achieving that particular impossible goal, the Duke was about as satisfied with his command as he had any right to expect in this less-than-perfect world. It wasn't going to get much better, at any rate, and at least he could count on its doing pretty much what he asked it to at sea. The problem was convincing his fellow admirals that what he wanted to do needed doing before they put to sea.
"Thank you, Sir Kevin," Blackwater said as the flag captain completed his briefing.
Then he looked down the table at Sharpfield and Mondeer.
"I believe this information puts a rather different complexion on our own situation," he said. "Clearly Harald's known a great deal more about our plans and our capabilities than any of us had believed was possible. Exactly how that information came into his hands is something I'm sure all of us would like to know. What matters for our purposes right this minute, however, is what we do now that we know what he's apparently done on the basis of his knowledge."
"With all due respect, Your Grace," Sharpfield said, "do we really know what he's done? We have a single report from a single one of Prince Hector's spies, even granting that the man is completely honest, and that the information he's reported is true to the best of his own knowledge, he could be in error on some or all of the points in his report. And even if every word of it's completely accurate, we have no way of knowing what's come of Harald's actions."
The Chisholm Admiral shook his head with a half-snort.
"Personally, I think Harald would have to have been out of his mind to try something this idiotic, and I can't remember the last time someone accused Harald of Corus of stupidity. The chances of his even finding Malachi and Whiteford at sea, whether he knew the originally proposed location for their rendezvous point or not, would be minute. And even if Caleb did find them, his galleons would have been outnumbered by something like 6-1 when they engaged."
He shook his head again.
"I simply can't see Harald taking that sort of chance with that big a piece of his total navy and his own son's life when he'd have to be shooting almost completely blind."
"Then what do you think he's done, my lord?" Blackwater asked courteously.
"I don't have the least idea," Earl Sharpfield said frankly. "I suppose it's remotely possible he's trying some sort of complicated double bluff. If he ostentatiously sent his galleons off early, counting on us to still have at least some spies in Corus to report the fact, he could want us to believe the topsails we've been seeing belong to merchantmen, when they're actually the sails of his war galleons. On the other hand, I'd have to admit that trying something like that doesn't strike me as a great deal more reasonable than sending his entire force of galleons herring off into the middle of the Parker Sea."
"Well, he's obviously done something with them," Mondeer said, "and I, for one, am inclined to trust your man's information, Your Grace."
He inclined his head in Blackwater's direction.
"I'll defer to Earl Sharpfield's greater experience at sea, and agree it seems like a remarkably foolhardy risk on Harald's part. Still, if he did have better knowledge of our plans than we believed he did, he must have known the odds, the forces being assembled against him. He may have calculated that he couldn't hope to defeat our combined forces after all of them were joined together, and decided that some chance, even if it were a slim one, of preventing us from ever uniting all of our ships at all, was better than a certainty of seeing his own fleet destroyed after we did."
"That's certainly possible," Sharpfield acknowledged a bit grudgingly. "It just seems so unlike Harald. He's very like his father was. I met the old king when I was a captain. The queen's father chose my ship to transport a diplomatic mission to him, and my impression of him was that he was always ready to take chances, even bold ones, but only when the possible return outweighed the risk and the odds were in his favor. Everything I've ever heard about Harald says he thinks exactly the same way, and that isn't, can't be the case here, whatever his reports seem to indicate."
"I would tend to agree with you under normal circumstances, my lord," Blackwater said. "In this case, though, I believe we have to at least tentatively accept that the information is correct. And if it is, then I think we must also assume that either Caleb managed to intercept Duke Malachi, or else he didn't. If he did, they've fought a battle, which one of them won. If Caleb won, or even if he simply failed to make contact at all, he should be back sometime in the next 2 to 4 5 days. If Duke Malachi won, he should be here within the same time frame. If he slipped past Caleb without making contact at all, he should be here within no more than the next 2 5 days. What we have to do is decide how to proceed until one or the other of them turns up.
I'm very tempted to suggest we do nothing to bring on a general engagement until Duke Malachi arrives," Sharpfield said. "That was the original plan for the campaign, and it would offer at least some protection against the possibility that Harald truly is trying some sort of complicated misdirection with the movements of his galleons. And," he added, looking Blackwater straight in the eye, "if Duke Malachi and Baron Whiteford don't arrive, that should be a fairly pointed indication of what will happen to our galleys in a battle against these new galleons of theirs."
"I disagree, Sir Luke," Mondeer said in a courteous tone. "I believe we should do our very best to provoke, even force, a general engagement as soon as possible. If Duke Malachi won against Caleb, then we'll be in an even better position to proceed after his arrival if we've managed to defeat Harald in the meantime. If he lost, but still managed to inflict heavy losses on Caleb, then it's important that we neutralize Harald's galleys to prevent them from supporting and covering Caleb on his return. And if Caleb won without suffering significant losses, it's more important than ever that we not have to worry about facing Harald's galleys at the same time we confront him."
"I find myself in agreement with Earl Mondeer, my lord," Blackwater said to Sharpfield. "I'll confess that I myself would feel much more comfortable if we had some independent confirmation of this single report. Nonetheless,
It seems to me we have to at least probe to see whether or not Harald's galleons are in company with the rest of his fleet. If it turns out they are, our information is obviously in error. If it turns out they aren't, then I think Earl Mandir's suggestions will have considerable merit. While it's true the original plan for this campaign required us to wait for the arrival of the Tarosian and Dolaran squadrons, it's also true the reason we were waiting for them was to attain a decisive numerical superiority over the Carizians. If all we face is the 80 galleys of Harald's peacetime navy, then we have a decisive superiority at this moment.
There was silence for a moment, and then, almost as if against his will, Sharpfield nodded slowly. 7. Off Triton Head, Karras Sea.
They are coming south, Your Majesty.
Captain Trevithan gave King Harald a rather peculiar look. The sort, Harald reflected, which was normally reserved for prophets, madmen, or Sejun.
Are they indeed, Denzel?
He responded mildly, looking up from his lunch.
Yes, they are, and in considerable strength, his flag captain said. According to Flash, it looks like their entire fleet, in fact. I see.
Harald picked up his wine glass and sipped, then wiped his lips with a snowy napkin.
Well, Denzel, he said then, if they seem to be intent on offering battle, I suppose they have a reason to. We, on the other hand, do not. Not an immediate reason, Your Majesty, no,
Trevithan agreed. The emphasis on the adjective was slight but unmistakable, and Harald smiled.
Denzel, Denzel, the king shook his head. I know giving ground against these people goes against the grain, and I know Brian kicked their arses for them the last time they came this far south. But you and I both know they wouldn't be here if Blackwater didn't feel fairly confident we wouldn't be doing that to them again. And whatever they may want, what we want is to continue to buy time until Caleb returns. True enough, Your Majesty, Trevithan conceded.
He did not, Harald noticed, point out that no one in the Carizian fleet knew whether or not Caleb was returning. The king felt a sudden, powerful temptation to tell his flag captain what he knew, but he suppressed it easily enough.
Pass the word to Brian, he directed instead. Tell him to execute the plans we discussed yesterday. Well, this is unexpected,
Duke Blackwater commented, and Sir Kevin Mergan chuckled beside him.
I hadn't realized what a gift for understatement you have, Your Grace,
the flag captain said when Blackwater looked at him, and the Duke smiled. But then the smile faded, replaced by a thoughtful frown as he considered the report.
South,
he murmured, scratching the tip of his nose while the brisk northeasterly ruffled his hair.
Why south? It does seem peculiar, Your Grace, Mergan observed. I would have expected him to fall back towards Rockshoal Bay if he was intent on avoiding action. So would I, Blackwater agreed.
He cocked his head and clasped his hands behind him, standing by the starboard bulwark of Coruscant's aftercastle, and rocked up and down on his toes for several seconds.
Whatever he's up to, Your Grace, Mergen offered, it does look as if he wants to avoid a general engagement. Which would appear to confirm the report that his galleons are somewhere else,
Blackwater nodded.
If all he has is 80 galleys, of course he doesn't want to fight our combined strength, but this business of falling back away from Rockshoal Bay, that bothers me. You think he's trying to draw us into some sort of ambush, Your Grace? An ambush by what? Blackwater asked.
The frustration in his question wasn't directed at his flag captain, as Mergen understood perfectly, and the Duke flung out one arm in a sweeping gesture at the long columns of Allied galleys forging steadily southwest.
"If our information's correct, he doesn't have anything he could ambush us with. And if our information isn't correct, what point would be served by moving clear down into Darkos Sound before offering battle?
Perhaps he's simply trying to avoid being trapped inside the bay, Your Grace," Mergen suggested after a moment.
Blackwater looked at him, one eyebrow raised, and the flag captain shrugged.
"We've always assumed the Carizians would fight to hold the bay, Your Grace. What if we were wrong? What if Harald's willing to let us have the bay, if that's what it takes to prevent us from pinning him down?"
"In theory, if he did that, it would give us the opportunity to send a raiding force past Lark Island,"
Blackwater said thoughtfully.
"Would he run that risk?
That depends on how great a risk it would be, doesn't it, Your Grace? If we got even a few galleys loose in Howell Bay, we could do a lot of damage. But if he has a few galleys of his own waiting there, or just on the other side of Lark Island, covering North Channel, we'd have to commit a much larger force if we hope to break through successfully.
Which might give him the opportunity to come in behind our main force after we've weakened it by detaching a big enough squadron for the job,"
Blackwater said, nodding slowly.
"There's this too, Your Grace," Mergen said. "If he's waiting for his galleons to come back from wherever they've been, he'll try to avoid a fight to the finish until they get here. And he won't want to be stuck in a pocket like Rockshoal Bay if his son needs help out in the Kurris Sea."
"I was thinking the same thing,"
Blackwater frowned some more.
"If he is waiting for Caleb's return," he went on after a few seconds, "then perhaps the fact that he's falling back to the south indicates the direction from which he expects Caleb to appear. The last thing he'd want would be for our complete fleet strength to be between him and Caleb, where we'd have the best chance of defeating either of his two forces in isolation."
"Unless he's thinking in terms of a converging attack,"
Mergen pointed out, and Blackwater laughed harshly.
"Sharpfield hates our guts, Kevin, but he's got a point about Harald and the sort of risks he's likely to take. Try to catch us between two widely separated fleets, each of them weaker than we are, when he can't even be certain when the other fleet is going to arrive?"
Blackwater shook his head.
"Neither one of them would even know we were engaged with the other until after the battle was over."
He shook his head again, even more firmly.
"No, that's the sort of over-clever plan someone like Magwer might come up with. Harald's too good a seaman to try something that foolish."
"I didn't say it was likely, Your Grace," Mergen pointed out. "I simply threw it out as one possibility."
"I know."
Blackwater reached out and patted his flag captain on the shoulder in a rare public display of affection.
"And I do think you have a valid point about the reasons he'd want to stay out of Rockshoal Bay, especially if he is expecting Caleb's return."
"How far south do you think he'll go before standing and fighting?"
Mergen asked.
"Probably no further than Darkos Strait,"
Blackwater replied after a moment.
"Darkos keeps nowhere near as good a base as Lark Island, but it would do in a pinch, at least for a while. And the passage between Darkos Island and Crown Cape is less than 30 miles wide at high water. At low water it's a lot narrower, and the safe channel's even narrower than that. He could fall back into the strait, and we'd play hell trying to follow him up.
But we could always circle around through Silver Strait and come up behind him,"
Mergen pointed out.
"Not without splitting our own forces,"
Blackwater countered.
"We'd have to leave someone to keep him from simply heading north again, which would give him the opportunity to defeat one of our forces in isolation. Or that's what he may be thinking, at least."
"And what are you thinking, Your Grace?"
Mergen asked, looking at him shrewdly.
"I'm thinking that if he's foolish enough to let him be trapped inside Darkos Strait, I'll go ahead and split my forces,"
Blackwater replied.
If we drive him back into the Narrows, then we can afford to reduce our forces north of the Strait, because we'll have the same narrow front to protect he does, which means we can probably hold any attempt of his to break back out into the Sound with no more than a quarter or a third of our total strength while we send all the rest around behind him. Do you really think he'll be that foolish, Your Grace? No, he probably won't, but I can always hope. In the meantime, it's the next best thing to 600 miles to Darkos Island. At our present speed, that's almost a 5-day. And however shy he's being right now, I think we can count on him to do his best to make our lives miserable between now and then. The next several days ought to be interesting.
8. HMS Royal Caris, Darkos Sound.
Harald of Caris stood on his flagship's aftercastle, gazing towards the eastern horizon, where summer lightning seemed to flash and blink through the darkness. It wasn't lightning, of course, and his jaw tightened as he wondered how many of his subjects were dying out there.
"Not many, if it's going according to plan," he told himself. "Of course, it never does go according to plan, does it?"
"Commodore Niles knows his business, Your Majesty," Captain Trevithan murmured, and Harald turned to look at the flag captain.
"Do I look that anxious?"
he asked wryly, and Trevithan shrugged.
"No, not really, but I've come to know you rather better than most, I think, Your Majesty."
"That's certainly true," Harald agreed with a chuckle.
"Still, you're right. And someone had to do it."
"Exactly, Your Majesty," Trevithan agreed.
The flag captain bowed slightly and turned away, allowing his king to return to his own thoughts, which, Harald discovered, were somewhat lighter after Trivethan's intervention. The king drew a deep breath and made himself consider the last 11 days. Blackwater was clearly determined to pin him down and destroy his fleet once and for all. To be honest, Harald was a bit surprised by the Coruscantian's tenacity and the degree of tight control he seemed to be able to maintain over his composite fleet. After Harald had used the cover of night to slip his entire fleet around Blackwater's right flank and break back north of the Duke, Blackwater had simply turned around and started following him back towards Rockshoal Bay. He'd refused to spread his units in an effort to cast a wider net, which was what Harald had more than half hoped he might do. Instead of offering up more isolated squadrons for the Carisians to snap up, however, Blackwater had maintained his concentration, except for his scouting ships, and continued his dogged pursuit. Clearly he wanted a decisive battle, but equally clearly he wasn't prepared to court a defeat in detail in his efforts to get one. And despite all Harald's maneuvers, all the wiles and cunning he could bring to bear, the Coruscantian had gradually closed the distance between their two fleets. Harald's galleys were individually bigger than their opponents, and better designed for open water. But that also meant they were at least marginally slower under oars at the best of times, and they'd been continually at sea for almost 3 months now, except for brief returns to port on a ship-by-ship basis to replenish their water tanks. Their bottoms had become foul, which was making them even slower. Under sail, that wasn't much of a problem, because they also had bigger, more powerful sails. But working to windward under oars, it was. Which was why Blackwater's fleet had been less than 25 miles south of Harald's flagship at sundown.
"I've got to get back south of him again, where I can run on the wind,"
Harald told himself yet again, watching the gun flashes grow in intensity.
"But at least this should be the last time I need to."
He wanted to go below, to the refuge of his cabin, away from that silent heat lightning, but he couldn't. Commodore Cody Niles was out there with his squadron, attacking a force many times his own strength, solely to convince Blackwater that Harald was trying to break past him to the east, not to the west. The least the king who'd sent them out could do was stand here and watch. 9. Gallicorisand, Darkos Sound. The Duke of Blackwater walked on deck after an abbreviated breakfast and looked sourly over the bulwark. Under normal circumstances, he conceded, the sight before him would have caused him considerable pleasure. Two big galleys lay on Coruscant's port quarter. The nearer ship flew the gold-on-black standard of Carus under the white-on-orange of Coruscant. The other flew the Carisian colors under the silver doomwhale and royal blue field of Chisholm. They were the first two important prizes Blackwater's fleet had captured, and it was already obvious from the preliminary reports that there were some significant peculiarities about the way their guns were mounted.
"Peculiar or not," he thought grimly, "they obviously work well enough, don't they?"
Capturing those two ships and destroying a third had cost him four of his own galleys. Actually, it had cost him six, but the damage to two of them was repairable. Of the other four, one had been sunk outright, and the other three had been reduced to such shattered wrecks that he'd ordered them burned himself after taking off the survivors of their crews. And after all of that, almost two-thirds of the Carisian force had actually managed to disengage and run.
2-1 losses, he reflected, and we'll probably never know why the third one caught fire and blew up, which means we can't exactly count on doing it again.
He didn't much care for the implications. Of course, he had more than twice as many galleys as Harald, but having a dozen or so battered ships left after finishing off the last Carisian wasn't exactly likely to delight Prince Hector.
"Good morning, Your Grace." "Good morning, Kevin."
He turned to face the flag captain, whose breeches were soaked to well above the waist.
"Have you had an adventure this morning?"
the Duke asked mildly, raising one eyebrow.
"I mistimed it when I jumped for the entry port ladder, Your Grace."
Mergen grimaced humorously, and Blackwater snorted, although it wasn't always funny by any means. Mistiming the transfer from a small boat to the ladder-like battens fastened to a galley's side for the steep climb to its deck could have fatal consequences. More than one man had been crushed against the side of his own ship when an unanticipated wave slammed the boat he'd just left into him. Others had been washed off their perch by similar waves, sucked under the bilge, and drowned. Blackwater had almost suffered that fate himself when he was a much younger man.
"I'm glad to see you're no worse for wear," he told the flag captain,
then jerked his head at the two prizes.
"What do you make of them?"
"I'm impressed, Your Grace," Mergen said soberly.
"And I understand what happened to Tanler Keep much better now. They're bigger than our ships, which I expected, of course, but those guns of theirs..."
The flag captain shook his head, his expression half admiring and half chagrined.
"I don't know why no one else ever thought of it, Your Grace. Their broadside weapons are much shorter than our guns, and lighter, lots lighter. They're like sawed-off krakens mounted where only a falcon ought to be able to go. And all of their guns have these pivot things on the sides of the barrel, almost like the sheaves in a block."
Mergen's hands moved, as if trying to twist something invisible in the air in front of him.
"It lets them actually elevate and depress their guns. And there's something different about their gunpowder, too."
"Different?
Different how?" "It's like grains, Your Grace. Grains of sand. Or maybe more like coarse ground salt."
Blackwater frowned, trying to visualize what Mergen was describing.
"I found out how they're managing to fire that quickly as well, Your Grace,"
Mergen told him, and the Duke's eyes sharpened.
"It's another thing I can't understand why nobody else ever thought of," the flag captain said. "They've simply sewn the charges for their guns into cloth bags. They ran the entire bag down the barrel with one shove, instead of using ladles. And they've got some sort of thing mounted on the gun. It's like a little hammer with a piece of flint stuck onto it and a spring.
They pull the hammer back, and when they're ready to fire, the spring snaps it down and strikes sparks onto the priming instead of using slow match or an iron.
Blackwater grimaced. He'd always known Carizians were irritatingly innovative. After all, that was a big part of what the Grand Inquisitor had against the kingdom. But even from his present grasp of Mergen's explanation, which he knew was imperfect at this point, he began to understand how 8 galleys had done so much damage before they were driven off.
No, he told himself harshly. Not driven off. The other 5 voluntarily disengaged after they'd done what they came to do. That's all very interesting, Kevin. I mean that. And I'd appreciate it if you could sketch some of the things you're talking about for me, so I could look at them over lunch. But for right now, what do we know about the rest of Harald's ships?
About what you surmised at sunup, Your Grace, Mergen replied, and it was his turn to grimace.
You were right. It was a diversion, and while we were all looking east, Harald slipped back past us to the west. His main body's about 20 miles south of our main body and opening the range slowly but steadily with these wind conditions.
Shan Wei sees the man, Blackwater said, far more mildly than he felt, and shook his head in grudging admiration. Now we'll have to chase him all the way to Darkos Island all over again.
Do we really want to do that, Your Grace? Mergen asked diffidently, and Blackwater looked at him sharply.
What I mean, Your Grace, is that, as you yourself pointed out when we began pursuing them, if they're expecting Caleb to return from the south, and if they've managed to make us spend this long chasing them, we may not be able to catch up again before he gets here.
Or before Duke Malachi gets here, Blackwater said. He's supposed to be coming from the same direction, if you recall.
With all due respect, Your Grace, Duke Malachi is already the better part of a month overdue. He may still be coming, but if they've managed to put as many guns like the ones I was just examining aboard their galleons as our spies had reported, and if they actually managed to intercept Malachi, then the Duke's taken significant losses. Those galleys, he waved at the 2 prize ships, only have 6 guns in each broadside. According to our spies, their galleons have as many as 20.
I know.
For a moment, Blackwater's expression showed a bleakness he would not have permitted anyone else to see. Then he drew a deep breath and shook himself.
I know, he repeated. But we did manage to take or sink a 3rd of their galleys last night, and Caleb would have been outnumbered by Duke Malachi by an even greater margin than they were outnumbered by the column they attacked. You're probably right about what galleons with that much firepower could do, but surely they would have suffered losses of their own, and they didn't have that many galleons to begin with.
With all due respect, Your Grace, I certainly hope you're right about that, Mergen said with a wry smile.
So do I, Blackwater admitted. Still, whatever their galleons look like, they can't have these new guns of theirs widely distributed through their galleys. If they did, they'd have sent more of them along last night. For that matter, if all their galleys had them, they wouldn't have bothered to run away from us in the first place.
He snorted with bleak humor and glowered at the prizes, then shook his head.
I expect they concentrated on putting all the new guns they had aboard the galleons, he said. Which should mean that if we can ever get to grips with that slippery bastard Harald, we should still be able to crush him. And if they do have galleons headed back this way from the Parker Sea, we'd better deal with Harald before they get here.
To be honest, Your Grace, Mergen said slowly, his expression troubled, I'm not at all sure the galley hasn't just become thoroughly out of date.
I think you're probably right about that, Blackwater said grimly. And the bad news is that we don't have any galleons of our own. But the good news is that the Carizians don't have a lot of them, and we can start building them from an almost even footing now that we've figured out how they're mounting their guns.
Exactly, Your Grace, the flag captain nodded. And what I'm wondering, if that's true, is whether or not there's any point in engaging Harald.
Blackwater looked at him sharply, and Murgin shrugged.
Even if we completely destroy Harald's fleet, we'll only be capturing or sinking ships nobody's going to want in another year or two, Murgin pointed out.
Oh, I see what you're thinking now, Blackwater said, but he also shook his head. I see two reasons to go ahead and smash Harald, he said. First of all, we don't know what's happened to Caleb. He may have been badly defeated by Malachi and Whiteford, despite all our present doom and gloom. Even if he won, he's probably taken losses, quite possibly enough losses, that even with all the wonderful new guns he could put aboard his remaining ships, we could still beat him. But second, even if Caleb is coming back with a fleet we can't possibly face in battle, at least until we've built ourselves a fleet just like it, we still need to destroy this fleet. There are kings aboard one of those galleys, Kevin. If we kill him, or even better, capture him, the consequences will be enormous. And even if we fail to do that, those ships have got thousands of trained officers and seamen aboard them. Those are the men they'll use to crew any more galleons they might build. We need to kill as many of them as we can now, while our ships are still equal to theirs, to deprive them of all that experienced manpower.
Murgin looked at him for several seconds, then nodded slowly with an expression of profound respect.
I wasn't thinking that far ahead, Your Grace. Perhaps, he smiled thinly, that's why you're an admiral, and I'm not.
Well, Blackwater said with an answering, somewhat crooked smile.
One of the reasons, anyway. Perhaps. Of course, there's still the problem of what happens if Caleb turns up at an inopportune moment, Your Grace, Murgin pointed out.
We've got picket ships out to the north, Blackwater countered, and Harald is south of us. If Caleb turns up from the south, then we turn around and run north. And while I realize these new rigging ideas of theirs make their galleons more weatherly, I strongly doubt that they can sail straight into the wind the way we can row.
And if we're wrong, and he turns up from the north, Your Grace?
Then our pickets will tell us he's there long before Harald can know anything about it, Blackwater replied. In that case, we make straight for Silver Strait and run for it. We'll probably have enough forewarning to get around Harald before he realizes what's happening, if we stop chasing him and just concentrate on running. And if Harald does get in our way, the Duke shrugged, we cut our way through him and inflict all the damage we can in the process.
10. Darko's Sound.
You hardly touched your supper, Lachlan Jessop observed.
King Harald turned from his contemplation of the stern windows at his valet's complaint.
Was there something wrong with it, Your Majesty?
Jessop inquired with a certain hurt dignity as he gathered up the dishes on his tray, and Harald shook his head with a smile.
No, there wasn't anything wrong with it, he said patiently,
ignoring the grin on Sergeant Harpar's face as the guardsman watched from the great cabin door he'd opened for Jessop.
And no, I have no complaints for the cook. And no, I'm not ill. And no, you can't bring me a snack later tonight.
Jessop regarded him with the mournful, martyred eyes only the most loyal and trusted of retainers could produce, and the king sighed.
But, he said, I promise to eat a simply enormous breakfast. There. Are you satisfied now?
I'm sure, Jessop said with enormous dignity, that it's not my place to be extracting promises from you, Your Majesty. He picked up his tray, elevated his nose ever so slightly, and left the cabin. Harpar held the door for him, and his grin got even bigger as the departing valet stepped past him.
You know, Gorge, the king said dryly,
The frightening thing is that he really thinks he means that.
Aye, Your Majesty, he does, the guardsman agreed. Still and all, down inside somewhere, he knows better.
Yes, he does.
Harald smiled fondly, then shook his head.
Good night, Gorge.
Good night, Your Majesty.
The guardsman touched his left shoulder in salute, then shut the door. Harald gazed at the closed door for the better part of a minute, then rose, his smile fading, and stepped out onto Royal Carus's sternwalk. He gazed up at the sky, where the fingernail pairing of a new moon gleamed faintly in the east. The musical bubble of the galley's wake came to him from below, coupled with the rhythmic sound of water sluicing along the sides of his flagship's hull. Stars burned brightly high overhead, and the following wind had freshened slightly and veered a bit back towards the west. It was a beautiful night, if a little on the dark side, and he gazed astern at the running lights of the other ships in Royal Carus's column. The men aboard those galleys were every one of them obedient to his orders. And, he knew, they executed those orders willingly, by and large, trusting him to get it right. But beyond the running lights he could see were those of the fleet he couldn't see, yet which was once again creeping closer. Soon now, very soon, he was going to have to decide whether to fall back south of Darkos Island or try to break around Blackwater's flank once more. He didn't want to go any farther south than he had to. If nothing else, there wasn't another base as good as Darkos Keep once he got down into the Middle Sea. But Blackwater was staying close to his heels, and the chances of his bamboozling someone as shrewd as the Coruscantian Duke got slimmer each time he had to make the attempt.
"That's not what's really worrying you, though," he told himself, gazing out at the night. "What's worrying you is that according to Caleb's and Merlin's estimate, and even allowing for how much further south we are right now, they should have made contact with Blackwater's picket ships no later than day before yesterday."
He smiled without a great deal of humor, and braced his forearms on the sternwalk railing as he leaned over it to take some of the weight off his right knee. He was certain the rest of the fleet must be beginning to wonder exactly what he had in mind with all this bobbing and weaving about the Carus Sea and Darkos Sound. He would have liked to have been able to tell them, too, but just exactly how he was supposed to inform even his most trusted officers that he decided to base his strategy and, for that matter, his hope for the very survival of his entire kingdom, the lives of all their families, and very possibly their immortal souls, on the services of what might well turn out to be a demon. He laughed softly, shaking his head, remembering Merlin's expression on this very sternwalk. Whatever else Merlin might be, he was clearly no omniscient being. In fact, that was one of the reasons Harald had decided to trust him, although he'd never told the Sajin, or whatever he truly was, that. Merlin could be surprised, which undoubtedly meant he could also make mistakes. But what Merlin could not do was to conceal what he felt. Perhaps the Sajin didn't realize that, or perhaps it was only his friends from whom he couldn't hide. But Harald had long since realized Merlin was a deeply lonely man, one who'd been hurt but refused to surrender to the pain. And whatever his origins, whatever his powers, he truly was committed to the purpose he'd explained to Harald in their very first interview.
"I realize it's possible he really is a demon, God,"
Harald Armach thought, gazing up at the clean, untouched beauty of the glittering handiwork of the deity he worshipped.
"If he is, and if I shouldn't have listened to him, then I apologize, and I ask for your forgiveness. But I don't think he is. And if he isn't, then perhaps you truly did send him, whatever he is. He's not very much like what I always expected an archangel to be like either, of course."
The king smiled wryly in the darkness.
"On the other hand,
I suppose you could send whoever you wanted to teach those corrupt bastards in the temple the error of their ways. If it's your will that I live to see that happen, I'll die a happy man. And if it isn't, then I suppose there are worse causes a man could die serving.
It wasn't the sort of prayer of which the Council of Vicars would have approved, and not just because of the content, but that was just fine with King Harald the Seventh of Carus. It was odd, he reflected. Despite his concern for Caleb's tardiness, despite the fact that the group of four had decreed Carus's destruction, despite even the fact that he fully realized that the defeat of this onslaught would only prompt the group of four to try again with even stronger forces, he felt a deep sense of content. He was far from blind to the realities of what was about to happen. If Carus lost this war, the consequences for all Harald cared for and loved would be catastrophic. And even if Carus won this war, it would only be to face another, and another beyond that. Harald doubted he would live to see the end of this titanic conflict, which he prayed nightly was only just beginning. But perhaps Caleb would, or Jean and Jeannette, or his grandchildren. And at least he'd taken a stand. At least he'd provided for the possibility that those grandchildren he hadn't met yet would live in a world in which evil and venal men, hiding their avarice and corruption behind the face of God himself, could not dictate their beliefs, exploit their faith in God for their own vile purposes.
Poor Merlin, he thought. So afraid I'd see where his purposes must ultimately lead. I wonder if he started to figure out that I've been in front of him almost all the way.
It was probably time he sat down and discussed the entire subject openly and frankly with Merlin, he decided. There was no longer any point pretending, after all. And once they could stop wasting time on all this diplomatic indirection, they could probably... King Harald's thoughts broke off as the pager strapped to his forearm vibrated suddenly. Prince Caleb and Merlin leaned over the chart table. The prince's frown was intense as he gazed at the copper coins Merlin had used as map tokens. "So this is their main force over here," Caleb said, tapping a roughly rectangular area of the chart delineated by the coins placed at each corner.
"Yes." Merlin stood back, folding his forearms and gazing at the prince's intent expression. Despite the tension of the moment, Merlin felt a temptation to smile at Caleb's almost absent tone. The prince's frustration as adverse winds delayed their passage had been palpable to all around him. Now that same frustration had transmuted itself into something else, and he was so focused on the task at hand that it clearly no longer even occurred to him to worry about where and how Merlin got his information. Just as he hadn't worried about how Merlin had just finished informing King Harald of their arrival. And these, Caleb's hand swept over the arc of smaller coins scattered to the north of Duke Blackwater's main fleet, are his picket ships.
"Yes," Merlin said again, and the prince straightened, still frowning.
"If these positions are accurate, he's let his pickets get too far astern," he said, "and too far from one another as well."
"True," Merlin agreed. "On the other hand, it's a clear night. Any cannon fire's going to be visible for a long way."
"Granted, but..." Caleb looked up with an evil smile. "There doesn't necessarily have to be any cannon fire, does there?"
"What do you have in mind?" Merlin asked.
"Well," Caleb crossed his own arms and straightened up, settling back on his heels. "He's using light units. For all intents and purposes, they're basically no more than dispatch boats. At most, they've got a few wolves."
Merlin nodded. Wolf was a generic term for any Safeholdian naval gun with a bore of 2 inches or less, Such small pieces, like the ones in Dreadnought's fighting tops, were intended almost entirely as anti-personnel weapons, essentially enormous single-shot shotguns, although they could also be used effectively against boats and launches. "I'm thinking," Caleb continued, "that if this picket here..." He unfolded his right arm to reach out and tap one of the coins with his forefinger. "Were to suffer a mischief sometime around Langhorne's watch, it would leave a gap between these two." He tapped two more coins. "Not only that, but I'm betting it's the relay ship for both of them, so even if they did see us, they couldn't report it to Blackwater. Which means we could get the main fleet to within 10 miles of his main body, maybe even less, between moonset and dawn." Merlin considered the chart, then nodded slowly. "And just how do you intend to arrange for it to suffer that mischief?" he asked politely. "I'm glad you asked that," Caleb said with a toothy smile.